Yeah, I think we should start. If people do not, Okay, so you know, I'm very sorry that I'm giving the talk on the essentially the very last possible date. Gary tried to find dates for me, but there was nothing available. But I think that there is some interesting stuff that I'll tell you. So those of you who are still around, I'm grateful to you, but you will probably see a few interesting things. Now, you know, these are the spintronics work that are going on in Maryland. It's actually, well, over the last 5 years. And so I will talk about spin Hall effect, and I'll also talk about in the second talk DMS. And both of these subjects, I think, are very well represented, perhaps even overrepresented in the spintronics meeting. We also have done a lot of work on many body effects in spin polarized electron liquids, basically generalizing lambda Fermi liquid theory to a situation where the system has arbitrary spin polarization. And I do not think this was represented at all in this spintronics program, although this is actually an important aspect of spintronics in the sense spin properties of carrier system. Yeah, he certainly has done some aspects of it. Right. Then we have done a lot of work on spin polarized carrier transport related to this problem. Spin coherence in semiconductors is a big topic at Maryland because it has connection to quantum computation, and I did give a talk on it, I think, in the first or second week. Daniel Loss kind of twisted my arms, and we had a session. Lou Shum, Daniel, and I talked on spin coherence. Spin relaxation in metals, some early work, mostly done by Yaroslav Fabian. I'm not working on it anymore, but it's a very interesting problem. Then we do a lot of work on spin computation in semiconductors, which is really big subject. Spin transistor is another topic. Then there's whole class of materials which are not quite semiconductors, but fall under the rubric of ferromagnetic semiconductors, magnetic oxides doped with titanium oxide doped with cobalt, zinc oxide doped with manganese. Then there are manganized double perovskites, various strong correlation materials. Then there is bilayer system, sometimes called pseudo-spintronics, which may have quantum computation applications, and then of course graphene. We are not working on all of these right now, but we are working on probably half of these things right now, and we have worked on all of these things over the last 5 years. Of course, there are a large branch of postdocs, which is why we can work on all these things. So in the first half, what I'll talk about is spin Hall effects, and we have done some work. Most of our work is extrinsic, but we have done work on other aspects also, and the work is done by these three individuals. Wang Kong Sei is a student, Victor Galitsky was a postdoc at Maryland and then actually a postdoc at ITP, and he's now an assistant professor at Virginia, and is joining Maryland, I think, in 2 weeks as an assistant professor at Maryland. Pavel Krotkov is a postdoc at Maryland. Also Igor Zutik, Yaroslav Fabian, and Anton Burkov, whom I actually do not know, he's a postdoc at Harvard, but a friend of Galitsky, they contributed, but I'm not talking that much of their work. So we all know, because you have had many talks on spin Hall effect, that this is a subject very dominated by theory, more than 200 papers, and there are, as far as known, only 5 experimental papers. The subject began in 1971 with the seminal paper of Dyakonov and Perel, which was ignored for a long time, but now everybody knows about it. And the experimental papers are Kato's work in Science 2004, these three are from Santa Barbara, David Oshalom's group. Then there's a very recent paper from Harvard, which I think is coming out in Nature, Tinkham, and all these four, I believe, are essentially aspects of extrinsic spin Hall effect, which is less controversial. I think there is really no question that extrinsic spin Hall effect exists. How large it is, and whether we can theoretically understand it, and so on, are important questions. I think Dyakonov and Perel never really thought that this is much. This prediction of theirs is of much experimental relevance because they expected it to be a very small effect. And then there is this work by Unterlich, and I'll have very little to say about it, but I'm sure that the Texas group has said as much as that can be said about this experiment. There is one experiment, and that is claimed to be in a two-dimensional, highly doped hole gallium arsenide system, and that is thought to be intrinsic spin Hall effect. I would not have much to say about it except for making some comments. So I believe the theory situation is still a mess. I was quoted in Physics Today as saying theoretical situation is a complete mess. It may not be a complete mess, but I believe it's still a mess. Although I know Iro Sinova claims that I believe it's not a mess anymore. I think it's still very messy. Let me just tell you that I think that this subject, unfortunately, is following its older brother, ferromagnetic anomalous Hall effect. Many of these things have been discussed, so I'm not discussing everything in great details, assuming that you know what I'm talking about. I'm just alluding. But in a paramagnetic environment where the spin orbit coupling is the main driving force, not long-range ferromagnetism. So let me remind you in a 30-second nutshell what I mean by that. So Karpos and Lettinger in 1954 wrote a very important paper, which I would say is basically prediction of intrinsic anomalous Hall effect. Okay. And immediately Schmidt wrote a paper saying, no, what happens is what we would call extrinsic anomalous Hall effect. It's all skew scattering. That's 1955. And basically, Karpos-Lettinger paper was just suppressed. You know, it's a beautiful paper. And then Berger in 1970 wrote a paper saying, no, it's all side jump. And Schmidt and Berger and their followers fought for a while. Then Nozias and Lewiner wrote what I consider to be an extremely important paper. It's not that well known, not that highly cited, but really beautiful paper in Journal de Physique. In 1973, typical Nozias paper, you know, went through everything very carefully. And basically everything I learned about this subject is reading this paper carefully. And they concluded tentatively that there is really no, Nozias concluded there is no evidence for anything like an intrinsic anomalous Hall effect. Very carefully crafted sentence. You should go back and read the paper. It's a beautiful paper to read, even if you don't have a view on it. If you have a view on it and you agree with this statement, as I do, then it's even better. But they conclude probably there is, they basically conclude there is no evidence for anything that should be called intrinsic anomalous Hall effect. Everything, and they concluded that skew and side jump are both important, and depending on which system you're looking at, one is more important than the other. Beautiful paper. Then this intrinsic anomalous Hall effect was rediscovered or re-emphasized in 2002, now as a periphase argument, important paper because it started experimental activity in the subject. And it's a periphase argument, and Duncan Holden basically then reinforced this with his own way of periphase argument. But this is really our memory in physics is about 50 years. So 50 years has passed, so it came back, and it started a great deal of activity. And all I will tell you is that there is this very nice experimental paper from Mac Beasley's group. I give you the reference. I'm not going to give you references to our own paper, except in a few cases. You can download them from our webpage. And this business paper, the last sentence of the abstract is, the results seem to contradict the periphase mechanism. There are other experimental papers, I should say, which claim there is interesting anomalous Hall effect. So I'm not being completely fair, but I personally like this paper very much. Very careful, if you know typical Mac Beasley paper. Very, very careful paper. And they conclude that there is no reason to disagree with Nozias and Lewiner. It seems that all of their measurement, which is strontium ruthenate, they measured anomalous Hall effect in strontium ruthenate, all their measurements could be completely understood based on extrinsic anomalous Hall effect, side jump, and side jump and skew. Now, why am I giving you this history? If you have been following the talks that were given in the spintronics program so far, you'd see that there is like an uncanny, but rather disturbing parallel between what is going on in the spin Hall effect business with this anomalous Hall effect business. So maybe, in 2054, we'll kind of still argue this. I mean, scary thought. Because I think spin Hall effect, the experimental signatures are much, much weaker than spin anomalous Hall effect.
The Nozias paper says that there's no evidence. That's about a statement about experiment.
No, not evidence. No evidence. There is no reason to believe there is anything called intrinsic. It's a purely theoretical paper. They develop the theory, and it's a beautiful paper you should read. But all statements are theoretical. There was no experimental. There was no comparative experiment or anything. And Beasley comes to the same conclusion. Beasley actually doesn't cite Nozias and Lewiner. Comes to the same conclusion based on their own data. Okay. So I'm going to talk about our work only. So I apologize to all of you. At least a couple of leading experts in the subject are sitting here, but I will just assume you got your chance to represent yourself in earlier talks. Okay. So I'm not going to mention anybody's work at all and talk about our own work. And what I'll talk about is this very smart student I have, James Say. He did some work on extrinsic spin Hall effect, and then more recently intrinsic and extrinsic together. I believe this is really the only work where both of those things are dealt on an equal footing, and I'll explain to you what I mean by that. I should also qualify that I will talk about, whenever I talk about intrinsic or spin orbit coupling, I'm really thinking 2D Rajba model. that is not the only model for which you have intrinsic spin Hall effect. The Luttinger model, we have Dresselhaus, we'll have a few things to say about Dresselhaus, but we mostly concentrated on 2D Rajba model because the clean model to work theoretically. So well-defined Hamiltonian, you know exactly what you're doing. Its applicability experiment then will be limited by the fact that this is what we primarily considered. And then this, I think, is very important work. This is really, I can praise this work enormously because it's really Viktor Galitsky's work. It's one of those cases where it's not clear my name on the paper is justified, but Viktor felt it justified because I asked him to look into this problem. But it's all his work. Beautiful work, and I think it's very important work. Where the work spin Hall effect is not used at all in the theory, you just directly calculate boundary spin accumulation, directly. Forget about all this jargon, what is spin current, what isn't. Just say, I have a well-defined problem, and let me calculate spin accumulation. And its connection to the subject that's called spin Hall effect is very unclear at this stage. And I think theoretical work should be done in trying to connect this boundary spin accumulation to what is called spin Hall effect. And these are the publications, you know, these are all very recent papers, and we'll have some long papers very soon. Viktor's long paper, I will not be a co-author, but the long paper on Krotkov. And I'm going to talk about Krotkov's work very little. I'm not going to discuss a lot of it. Essentially, generalizing what others have done to non-parabolic bands. So let me start with Say's work. I was a student at Maryland. So we all know what spin Hall effect is, but it doesn't hurt to remind at least myself. So you have a bar, you apply voltage, so there will be a longitudinal current and there is an electric field, and then if the system has spin orbit coupling, then you can have boundary spin accumulation. And apparently a spin current will flow in this direction and a spin voltage will set up transverse spin accumulation. So in analogy with ordinary Hall effect, I think the terminology is slightly misleading. It's not incorrect, but anyway, it's just definition. So you have a spin current in this direction, an electric field in this direction. Okay, so it's analogous to Hall effect, but you know, do not need any B field, but there is really no charge current in this direction. So everything is fine. No fundamental theorem is being violated. And there are two kinds of spin Hall effects, as you all know, extrinsic. Extrinsic is not controversial. We are talking about a system without strong spin orbit coupling. So the spin current is a well-defined object because you do not have much spin precession. You can talk about spin current. There is something that's almost conserved because spin orbit coupling is weak. So when it comes to extrinsic, all the standard terminologies apply and all these controversies disappear because spin current is essentially conserved. You're talking about the material without strong spin orbit coupling, but what is arising is that impurity scattering, and as we know from fundamental atomic physics, when you have impurity scattering, then if you look at the Dirac equation, there'll be it's called Mott scattering in atomic physics, known since 1929. And 1930, you'll have spin-dependent directional scattering. And you'll have skew scattering and side jump, and that's called extrinsic. And I'm going to show it to you in some more details in a minute. And then there is intrinsic, for which you do not need any impurities. There is no impurity-induced scattering. But you have Berry curvature effect. So in some sense, you can think of it, it's not a good analogy that in unit cell already you have scattering because you have spin orbit coupling in the band structure itself. Okay, so it's a fundamental band structure effect, and you could have Dresselhaus effect, spin orbit coupling, or you could have. I should have emphasized that extrinsic is contributed to electrons holes near Fermi level. So this is like a standard transport phenomena. With impurity scattering, spin up goes in this direction, spin down goes in that direction, and it's just standard transport phenomena. It's the electrons near the Fermi level that are contributing. On the other hand, here, all the electrons contribute. So this intrinsic is quite unlike anything else we know. And it could arise from either Rajba or Dresselhaus. It can occur in perfectly clean sample. And the moment you say perfectly clean sample, what you mean by transport becomes very ill-defined. So there are all kinds of conceptual questions with intrinsic spin Hall effect, which we are just beginning to understand. Because as we know, you need impurities to define transport properties. So one has to be very careful about what is going to zero first, and so on and so forth. And spin Hall conductivity then defined in a standard manner, parallel to ordinary Hall conductivity. So this is spin current, and I use the word current with an inverted quote. And then you have a spin Hall conductivity. And for example, then you can calculate this quantity from this definition in an infinite system using the Rajba coupling. And there are many, many papers on this subject. and many, many talks in this particular workshop. And if you just use Rajba coupling and do not worry about all the subtleties I was mentioning, then you immediately get a universal spin hull conductivity in a very important paper by from Texas, Alan McDonald and his co-workers. This was pointed out just a couple of years ago. Of course, no impurities, you do not have really conductivity, so it was immediately realized that you need to do something, and I'm going to come to that. So let me just go through the experiments very fast, particularly since David Ashalem is not here. I do not feel the need to explain things in details, and I know that his group has given many talks. Conference itself had to invite talks by them, and then I'm sure there are more talks. So you know, the basic idea here is that it's really a very clever experiment. You pick up the signature of the spin accumulation by looking at the edge spin properties through optics. And the amount of spin accumulation is minuscule. It's only a few spins, net spins. So you have to have extremely sensitive measurement. I mean, you know, if the measurements did not exist and somebody told me the plan of this measurement, I would have said this would never work. It's just such a, you need such sensitivity. But Ashram's group made it work, and I have spent a lot of time looking at these experiments. I cannot claim that I understand everything, but it's clearly a, you know, very, very important experiment, which shows that you have spin accumulation, very small effect, and its explanation is that it is the experimenters themselves in their original paper said that it's likely to be extrinsic spin hull effect. The effect is very small, so the spin accumulation is, you know, 0.1%, okay? And if you convert that into spin conductivity by some hand-waving type of argument, you get spin conductivity, spin hull conductivity be very, very small. Then there is a second experiment, C et al., which is related to the first experiment in two-dimensional system now, two-dimensional electron gas that was bulk. And again, its spin accumulation is due to spin precession now. Again, a very small effect. Again, a very important experiment, and the experimentalists conclude, and we concur, we agree that it's extrinsic spin hull effect. I think more or less the community agrees that these two experiments from Santa Barbara are extrinsic spin hull effect. I mean, Gerrit, in this workshop, was that question? I assume that part people more or less agree. I certainly believe that these are extrinsic spin hull effect. And then there is a third experiment. I'm not talking historical sequence. I think the first published paper was the Kato et al., second published paper was this one, then C was the third published paper. And this paper is a highly doped 2D hole gas. In whole gallium arsenide systems, of course, spin orbit coupling is very strong. And since spin orbit coupling is very strong, you anticipate that intrinsic effect would be there. And also the mobility here was quote unquote high. It's not high by, you know, my definition, but it's high by the standards of this sort of measurements, much higher, for example, than the electron samples that Santa Barbara group looked at. And here the effect is somewhat larger. The measurement is a totally different technique using basically recombination and looking at the polarization dependent recombination. I do not understand all the aspects of this particular experiment. No detailed experimental paper exists. But again, people who have looked at it very carefully, I did not look at this experiment as carefully as I did with the Santa Barbara measurements. But people who have believe that this shows intrinsic spin hull effect, and apparently the numbers are not that different from the intrinsic number predicted by the Texas group. So what are the makers? So now I'm going to talk about extrinsic spin hull effect and try to quote unquote understand the Santa Barbara experiment. So one is skew scattering, and this is what pointed by Smith in 1958, and now you want to do the same calculation, but in the presence of spin orbit coupling rather than magnetization. So spin scattering, this is really Mohr scattering for atoms. So you have a left-right asymmetry of scattering cross-section depending on whether the spin is up or down. It's a very simple effect. So you have an L dot S coupling, and because of it, so it's just atomic scattering. And what you have, and then, let me go back. What you have is that the spin up or spin down will go in different directions, okay, depending on which way the electrons are moving. And then there is this side jump pointed out by Berger, again for anomalous Hall effect, and we just adapted that to the spin orbit coupling. And this is really like a vortex normalization, the current normalization by spin orbit coupling, so you get an anomalous current contribution. And both are present. So I did not quite understand this 20-year battle between Smith and Berger. It's a quantitative question, which sample will have which one more, and you have to do a calculation. The lateral displacement is very small. And in the presence of spin orbit coupling, of course, you will have both. And so James Say, my student, essentially adapted these things for spin orbit coupling, and this is our Hamiltonian. So now we have impurity scattering, so we are just doing diagonal parallel calculation, but actually calculating in details. We have to assume for something for the scattering. Normal semiconductors, what you have is charge impurities, so the interaction is long-ranged. We assume that there is screening. There is, of course, screening. But at first, our calculation, because you want to do an analytic calculation, we assume that the scattering potential is short-range, zero range. Okay, that's, of course, an approximation. And people at Harvard did somewhat better calculation, assume it to be Thomas Fermi. We did the same thing, but we wanted to do the whole thing analytically at first, so we assume that it's zero range scattering. And then we do Born approximation, and all we are doing is calculating how the Green's function will be normalized by this extrinsic spin orbit coupling. And you have to include both self-energy and vortex correction. And so these are the diagrams. Let me not get into the details. It's all published. There is nothing really very deep here. It's bookkeeping. So you have to keep the vortex correction. There is a charge vortex. There is a spin vortex. You have to keep both of them and then calculate spin hull conductivity. There's a side jump contribution. And we get some expression for it, analytic, because we have assumed short-range scattering. And it depends on the usual things other than fundamental constants. It depends on the basic coupling, basic spin orbit coupling due to impurities. This is not the spin orbit coupling in the bands or anything, the spin orbit coupling in the impurities. And then you have the Fermi momentum for spin up and spin down, because they're going in the different direction, and the corresponding densities. And you can combine them, and you get somewhat different formulas in 3D and 2D, but it's straightforward to do the calculation. Yes?
So, for a material like gallium arsenide, if one knew what impurities there are in the system, is this lambda zero something that can be easily...
Lambda zero can be calculated. It's going to be the only thing we need to emphasize here, which I didn't. Your question gives me a scope. Is that it's much more enhanced from what it will be in the vacuum. So this is really the vacuum, atomic spin orbit coupling. Okay, which really depends somewhat on what kind of impurities you have, how heavy it is, but it doesn't depend much. But if you go into the really vacuum, it's controlled by Compton wavelength. And that will be very, very small here. But what happens when you go to semiconductor, you can do a fundamental calculation, all the bands contribute. It's like effective mass changes, dielectric constant changes, it will change also. And yes, you can, knowing band structure, you can calculate what it is.
Band structure, I mean, we have analytical expressions for that.
Yes, yes. So if you know what impurities it are, you'll have some number for this. But how accurate it will be, this sort of first principles calculation, I do not think that you cannot really make a statement better than an order of magnitude, a factor of 3 or 4 or something like that, okay? But the difference between Compton wavelength and this is more like a factor of million. So this is why Xucheng Zhang originally felt these things will be totally unimportant in semiconductors. But semiconductor has this semiconductor background, so these things are enhanced. That's the band structure effect that's important. After that, the next factor of 2 or 3, maybe band structure people can do that calculation accurately, but I certainly cannot, okay? And then skew scattering, the diagrams again, we know. And now we are calculating the correction, the Green's function, in some sense, the self-energy correction. And again, since we are making a short-range approximation, I'm not going to go through the actual details of the formula. It's all in the paper. But now things depend on tau also, the transport lifetime. And the result before did not. The side jump did not depend on tau. Side jump was kind of a universal, except dependence on lambda zero. But skew scattering depends on tau. And we get a formula. And we can now combine everything. So we have to know what the actual scattering potential is. Assuming Thomas Fermi scattering, we can estimate what the scattering potential is. So you really have no adjustable parameter, and then you can combine the two contributions, the side jump and the skew scattering contribution, and ask, well, how large is the contribution? And the important thing that I need to emphasize now is that skew scattering and side jump come with opposite signs. So depending on which one is larger, you can have positive or negative contribution to the extrinsic spin hull effect. Both are small, and you're subtracting them and getting another small quantity. So overall order of magnitude is the only thing that matters, because you're subtracting two quantities of the order of 10 to the minus 4 and getting another quantity. Sign is not going to be something that you're going to bet your life or even your salary on. So if we estimate it, then all I can say is that it's order of magnitude agreement. The sign turns out to be, if I check the nominal numbers, this is what Nitin was asking, if I take what they should be for gallium arsenide, the sign is opposite of what the experimentalists see. But neither Bart Holperin, who the Harvard group did a very similar theory, we did diagrammatic Kubo formula, they did kinetic Boltzmann theory, and our results are very consistent with each other. And the difference are only in details. They also get the opposite sign, but the sign of the experiment is a bit unclear now. Okay, I mean, the experiment is not absolutely sure what the sign is. So the thing to emphasize is that essentially you are getting an order of magnitude of the spin hull conductivity from the accumulation, which is 0.1%, which is what experimentally see. And if we could do the band structure calculation accurately that Nitin was asking, maybe the sign would come out to be right. But it's important to emphasize at this stage, at least the sign disagrees with what the experimentalists originally in the paper said the sign is. But after our papers came out, the experimenters not so sure about their sign, because it's not so easy when you look at the experiment. You know, at first I thought, how come they cannot say the sign? But it's tricky. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure.
Sure. Then there's a spin orbit coupling constant associated with just the band structure, and you know, and related to the delta. But I thought that here, for the extrinsic spin hull effect, you're saying that the lambda that comes into play is due to whatever
impurities you have. Right.
So how do you get?
So the thing is that it depends only on the Z atomic number of the impurity. So that differs only by some factors. That's right. So what we did is that to take the Compton wavelength and renormalize it for the fact that there are bands. Now what you're asking is the next level question, that you know, if I knew exactly what impurity, what the Z value is, you know, if you put something which has Z value as 100, then that number will change by 100. But we assume the impurities are, you know, some light materials, because it's mostly sodium ions, as you know, in these things, okay? And you are right that if you can put some very heavy impurities, I expect the extrinsic effect to go up. I mean, but that's the next level. Okay.
The way the experiments got these conductivities out of the spin-up,
right?
You don't really have any doubts about that.
I do not have any comment on that. So we can discuss separately, you know, that thing, because you know they did it. We tried to do it also by some technique. I mean, what Gerrit is asking is, of course, the crucial issue, which I'll come to the last part of my talk. That experimentally, all one knows there is spin accumulation. Nobody has measured spin conductivity. Nobody has measured spin current. Theory, this theory and all the other theories, except for the theory of Galitsky that I'll talk about at the end. All these 200 papers that I talked about, you know, 199 of them calculates a spin hull conductivity, which is an ill-defined quantity in the presence of spin orbit coupling, not in this case, and then goes there. And so how you go from spin accumulation to spin conductivity, I think, is quite subtle. And I want to avoid that here, since we really didn't contribute. Yes, we accepted what they have at face value. Okay. And, you know, there are discrepancies. So here is the question Gerrit was asking. The experiments actually went from their spin accumulation to their spin conductivity by assuming some profile and using a paper by Shifeng Zhang. And I think reasonable people could disagree among themselves that whether, you know, this gives exactly the right spin hull conductivity or not. But
put in some spin flip scale.
I completely agree. I mean, your question is, you know, well taken. And there are, you know, discrepancies. This is the point. This is the point Nitin was making. This is unknown. This could easily have factor of 10 unknown things, not factor of 10 to the power 6, but 10. The potential in the zero range. But Harvard group did a calculation with that. So we are not dissatisfied at this stage that at least we have some understanding that if the number was factors of 10,000 or, you know, 1,000 different, I would say we don't understand. But let's just leave it there. We also went ahead in our paper, in our PRL. This work came out in PRL. We had to fight like hell for it to come out in PRL. We also compared the Unterlich's measurement, because the measurements exist. And what we found, again, let me not get into the details, because the same question Gerrit is asking comes up. How do they get these numbers here? And we found that if you just take their numbers at face value, they give a spin hull conductivity value, then what we calculate is one order of magnitude lower than what the experimentalist. So we concluded that experimentalist conclusion that what they see probably is intrinsic is not inconsistent what we have. But again, Nitin asks, how do I know? Maybe in their sample, which are 2D holes, maybe they have different kinds of impurities, and that lambda zero factor of 10 larger. I mean, that can't be ruled out. And in our paper, we conclude that even Unterlich's experiment could be extrinsic spin hull effect. We actually say that It can't be ruled out is what I say. We are not claiming it is, okay? And I think more work should be done on this thing, but I think only after more experiments come. I'm surely not working on the experiments until more experiments come. Now this is, I think, the more interesting thing, theoretically. So we have intrinsic, we have extrinsic. So the natural thing to do is to say, can you now do the extrinsic calculation, putting in the Rauschenbach coupling? So I asked my student to do this just as an aside. I said, look, this is not something we can publish. It will be a chapter in a thesis because I can predict to you what the result is going to be. The result is going to be leading order because we're doing analytic calculation. It will be intrinsic plus extrinsic because this is what perturbation theory teaches us, that if you have two small effects and you do a perturbation theory including both, then leading order, they just add, unless there is something funny going on and I did not think hard enough. If I thought hard enough, I realized something funny was going on. So he did the calculation just in a couple of weeks, because all we do, and the calculation, you know, if you don't do this kind of calculation, it looks very complicated. But for theorists, it's very simple what you're doing. We do exactly the same extrinsic spin-Hall effect calculation that I just described to you. But the Green's function now is denormalized by spin-orbit coupling. So the Green's function, instead of being free electron propagator, is the free Rauschenbach propagator. Okay, so it's a very well-defined conceptually. We do exactly the same calculation. We change, wherever we have free electron propagator, we change that to free Rauschenbach propagator. We take into account the Rauschenbach coupling into Rauschenbach coupling or Dresselhaus, you know, coupling into the propagator. Okay? So Green's function line, spin and charge currents are modified in the diagrammatic calculation. And then the calculation is basically the same, but you have many, many more diagrams now. You have to calculate something like 32 diagrams. And it's a good thing he loves actually calculate diagrams. But then we found an astonishing result, you know. And I was absolutely convinced the result was wrong. We found this result like almost a year ago. And I said, we can publish it, you have a mistake. What he found was this thing that... So let me just backtrack. Remember what we're doing. We have extrinsic and intrinsic both. Intrinsic is characterized by this Rauschenbach coupling alpha. Okay, never mind what alpha is if you do not know. It's the strength of the intrinsic spin-orbit coupling, the Rauschenbach coupling strength alpha. So you'd expect when alpha goes to zero, you recover the results you published in PRL. Because when alpha goes to zero, you just have the extrinsic calculation. What he was finding was alpha goes to zero, not only was he not finding the original result, that means alpha going to zero result was different from alpha identical to zero result. His result was of opposite sign. His result now agreed with the experiment. Okay, it's a very strange thing. So alpha going to zero limit was singular, was non-analytic. And I was sure it was incorrect. But then I had to, you know, so he checked it, he could not find any mistakes. He told me he could not find any mistake. I said, no, check it again. He checked it again, he could not find any mistake. So finally, I had to check it. That was not pretty. But I could not find any mistake. So then I said, we got to write it up. So we wrote it up in a very guarded manner, saying this is what we are finding, and we actually found the mathematical reason why it's happening. Basically, what happens is that you have charge vortex and spin vortex. By the way, this is connected with this result that I think Gerrit Bauer and Dimitrova first pointed out, and Ramion, the three different groups, that this result from Texas group, that Rauschenbach coupling produces universal large spin-Hall conductivity, vanishes the moment you have any impurity scattering. The vortex correction exactly cancels the self-energy correction, like magic. Okay, so there is something funny about Rauschenbach model, okay, because these two are totally different things. The same thing is causing this divergence here. So basically, you have a charge vortex and a spin vortex. Okay, so what happens is that when you switch off Rauschenbach coupling, charge vortex is fine. Okay, it just goes continuous. Charge vortex is continuous. It goes to zero. So when alpha is going to zero, you just recover the ordinary free electron term. But look at what happens to spin vortex. Spin vortex, the coupling comes in the denominator. So when alpha goes to zero, this delta is basically proportional to alpha. Delta is the spin splitting. When alpha goes to zero continuously, spin current vortex is becoming infinity, and it's canceling some other term that comes from the other part of the theory. So there is a non-analytic set that alpha is going to zero. This is analytically true. There is nothing you can do about it. So the sign is changing. Okay, very strange result. Okay. Now, if you do the hole, in holes you don't have anything like that. For holes, both spin and charge current vortex identically vanish as alpha goes to zero. Okay? So 2D electron gas and two-dimensional hole gas are different. It's an extremely theoretically interesting result, this thing. And whatever doubt I had about whether this result pathologic, something wrong or not, all vanished. I went to the talk by Bert Halperin at the conference, and Bart actually gave the whole talk on this thing. I mean, 50% of his talk, he called this result startling and said that he was sure the result is wrong, just as I was, and then he went through it, he found the result to be correct, and he actually figured the result out in his own way doing Boltzmann theory. And you know, and it's again a feature of Rajba model that once you calculate extrinsic in the presence of intrinsic, then the sign changes, and well, these are the details, and you have to calculate many more diagrams now, and essentially what happens, let me not bore you with all the details, that basic physics point is that the skew scattering contribution for electrons get completely cancelled. So the moment you turn on any intrinsic coupling, skew scattering goes to zero. It's very similar to what happens that intrinsic goes to zero the moment you turn on any impurity scattering. So, yeah.
Question,
yes.
We also have normal impurity scattering here, so which is not associated.
This tau is from normal impurity scattering. The tau here. So the tau here, that's why you have so many diagrams. So you have both normal and spin orbit. Both. Okay? Otherwise you would not get this result. So this tau that you're talking about is the ordinary charge relaxation time. Okay? So you can think of this as the kind of calculation you did, but we keep the spin orbit effect also in the impurity scattering. Okay? So this result, which I think is, you know, is a very interesting result, because it shows, it's a really theoretically very unexpected. So the sign changes. Now, remember that I told you that for the extrinsic effect, side jump and skew scattering comes with opposite sign. If you did not have this effect, then skew scattering is larger. Now that when skew scattering goes to zero, sign changes. So this could be, if I wanted to, the explanation for why experimental sign is wrong. Although, I mean, I think theoretically this is a very exciting effect, because there are not too many examples of non-analytic results in a leading order. So for holes, we get exactly what you'd expect, just additive. The two results are additive, okay? Just additive. This is what you'd have expected. But for electrons, as you vary alpha, Rajba coupling, and Rajba coupling is very, 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 very small, and you think that when it's very, 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 very small, extrinsic theory would apply better and better. No. At the point alpha is equal to zero, there's a singularity, and from this point, it changes sign and goes there. So spin hole conductivity is this. This is our old result, old Harvard result. And then, the moment it goes to zero, it changes, and the sign is a different sign. It's a very strange result, but it's correct. Okay? It's correct, and it has recently been refereed, and the referee said it's not very interesting. I'm not making it up. The referee said completely uninteresting. Okay? Which actually shocked me. I mean, if they said it's completely unimportant, because I think it's theoretically very interesting that this happens. This is telling us, see, people have looked for various symmetries in Rajba model. Nobody has been able to find any obvious symmetry which gives rise to all these interesting results. But there is something. Rajba model, is, I think, is a fascinating theoretical model. Now, what Bart pointed out, which is a very good thing, is that physically, of course, you don't expect things like that. Physically, you do not have a small parameter which, when it vanishes, suddenly you get a different result. So what would happen is that, I'm just quoting Bart Halperin, but I completely agree with him. He said this in the conference, that what would happen is that alpha becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. When alpha becomes smaller than beta, the Dresselhaus coupling, then this theory doesn't apply anymore. Now we have to have that theory, and that will take over. This may again be consistent with some of the things seen by the Santa Barbara group, but I am trying to get out of this field, because I think this field right now is not very healthy, unless more experiments come. But I think that's possible. That what is happening is that there is a cutoff in this theory, and for alpha, this is physically, not theoretically. Theoretically, it's a perfectly well-defined theory, because theoretically, it's perfectly well-defined to consider a model where there is no Dresselhaus coupling. But all experimental systems will have some Dresselhaus coupling. Even if it's a factor of a billion smaller than the Rajba coupling, when this becomes small enough, you have to take that into account. And once you take that into account, you don't have this non-analyticity, and then maybe the experiments in Santa Barbara would make sense. So we also, there is this recent paper, I like this paper very much, see et al., where they did very careful measurements of the spin imaging of the whole sample. I don't understand all the details of it, but we have done an earlier work where I tried to solve the ordinary drift diffusion equation, spin polarized drift diffusion equation, and basically equation of continuity all together. And I'm not going to discuss this in great detail. This is Rapid Communication published. And basically, you have to assume some boundary conditions. That's what everybody does. Boundary conditions are not derived. And if you assume some boundary condition, basically if you assume how spin behaves near the boundaries, you can solve these differential equations and produce what the spin what the spin profile is going to be. Unfortunately, depends very strongly on what kind of boundary conditions you assume. Okay, so you know, we do not know what the experimental boundary conditions are, and this goes back to the question Gerrit Bauer asked me. Experimentalists also assume something about the boundary conditions to derive, to go from spin accumulation to spin conductivity. Here we are going in the reverse direction. We are kind of calculating the conductivity and deriving what the spin would look like, and unfortunately it depends very strong. So this was boundary condition one, where we assume there is no transverse current, vanishing spin current of the boundary. Okay, so the spin current vanishes here is what we assumed, the two boundaries, two slabs. Here we use a different boundary conditions, spin current, but it's the other component, and the results are very different. The whole point of this paper, which came out early this year or late last year, is that extraction of a spin conductivity from spin accumulation measurement is not unique. It will depend strongly on boundary conditions, not weakly. And this goes back to the question. This is, I don't want to make any comment on you know, this is a fact. And so I do not really know what to say. Well, I know what to say, which is why I suggested to Viktor Galitsky, forget about spin Hall effect, calculate spin accumulation directly. That's what experimentalists measure. So conclusion is that this is the important conclusion, because this part is already published, that it's non-analytic. When alpha goes to zero, sign changes, and theoretically we completely understand it. Okay. So let me quickly go to the work of Pavel Krotkov. This I do not think is as important, although it's kind of cute. So what Pavel did, let me just skip these things. What Pavel did is to say, all right, for Rajba effect, we know that the original work of Sinova et al, this is the work I was alluding to as the Texas group, found a large spin hull conductivity, okay, of this magnitude. But that's, then for quadratic spectrum, these papers, I think this is Gerrit Bauer's work, and this is the Harvard work, this is Dimitrov. I think these two are early papers, but probably take a long time to get accepted. And all these papers concluded that this result is an artifact of leaving out impurity scattering completely. Once you have impurity scattering, and to define a conductivity, you need to have impurities, otherwise conductivity cannot be defined. Then you have to include vortex correction. The moment you include vortex correction, these two cancel exactly. What Pavel Krotkov found is that this cancellation may be somewhat accidental. For example, specifically, if you have a linear dispersion, then this cancellation seems not to take place. But in leading order, there is still cancellation. So up to order alpha, it's still cancellation. Order alpha square, you get a non-universal result for the spin hull conductivity. This was not realized because in Dimitrov's paper, in fact, there was a statement that this is valid for all orders. But when you look at her calculation, it's clear that the result is valid in leading order. Krotkov and Dimitrov are classmates in Lambda Institute. So Krotkov actually contacted Dimitrova, and Dimitrov agreed that our result is correct. There is no disagreement. So for example, for linear dispersion, you can do the calculation analytically, and this is the result you get. Okay? So it's a very small number. It's order alpha square, so it doesn't violate earlier known results. And as Bert Holperin told me, in order alpha square, there'll be other effects also. There'll be effects of spin precession at the boundary. So order alpha square, but it's a neat result that this vortex correction suppress the universal spin hull conductivity, but it does not fully cancel. It cancels it only in leading order. Now we are we'll have a long paper soon looking at all aspects of it, and there are some issues, rather subtle theoretical issues, which are of no experimental importance that you are struggling with, because it's really a very tricky question to define conductivity. It's a question of which limit you are taking.
What is the mu sub-zero in the denominator of this expression?
It's the velocity.
It's the Fermi velocity.
Yeah, right. So it corresponds to mm-hmm. So everything, you know, this is the only unknown, basically. Okay, so now let me tell you what the spin current business. Everything I talked about so far is the standard type of theory. These are all the talks you have had in this workshop. People assume something called spin current completely uncritically. Only Rajba, I think, had some questions in one of the talks I attended. And this definition of spin current is something like this. It's very physically motivated. You have a velocity, you have spin, and you assume spin up and spin down carriers are moving at a different velocity. And it's okay, I can define a spin current now. So I multiply by spin up by their velocity, spin down by their velocity, I subtract them, I get a nice quantity that's called spin current. Classically, that'd be quite good. Problem is, this quantity is not conserved. And to call something a current that's not conserved is very bad. To have a current, you must have a continuity equation, and it must correspond to some piece of physics in measurement. As far as I know, nobody has been able to come up with an actual measurement which sees this quantity, although it's intuitively quite obvious, okay? So here is a slide I have. So the problems with this definition, okay? Cannot be measured directly. That means there is no experiment that looks at this. No conjugate force exists. Unlike in electric fields drive current, there is nothing here that drives this thing, okay? And it's finite, even in Anderson insulators. What kind of current is this? It's finite in Anderson insulator. In fact, a paper was written saying that it's finite in Anderson insulator. Yeah, and I would say that's bad news. And its connection to spin accumulation gives you completely wrong result. If you just take the naive thing and integrate it, it's coming from the problem that is not conserved. So this is wrong. And you know why I can show this slide and jump up and down say it's wrong? Because it's not my slide. Spin current is observed. This is borrowed from a talk. I just borrowed it on the web from Chan New, who is one of the original co-authors with Sinova of that paper. So it's not me criticizing the definition. It's one of the original authors criticizing the definition. Now Chan New then has his own definition of spin current, where all he does is that he takes this non-conserved quantity, transfers it from right-hand side to left-hand side, combines it and says this is spin current that's conserved. Well, that's conserved. But as my colleague Viktor Galitsky says, there are infinite possibilities of defining conserved unitary operators should you all write PRLs on each of them, you know, and make big claims. Well, it's not clear that that's advancing science. Okay, I think we should really look at quantities that are measured. Okay, we cannot just have unitary operators and calculate them and write papers. And it's not clear to me that even, although I have not looked at it as carefully, that what Chan New then defined by taking the non-conserved part in there really is, it's conserved, but really it's experimentally relevant. So Viktor Galitsky, and it really is Viktor Galitsky's work, okay? So I can praise this without any shame and embarrassment. Basically asked a very well-defined question, that if I have a diffusive system, and if I have an electric field in x direction, can I measure the spin accumulation? Can I calculate the spin accumulation in y direction? It's a very well-defined question, okay? Unfortunately, it's also a very hard question. Very, very hard theoretically. But you know, Galitsky, being this Lambda Institute type physicist, actually solved the whole problem analytically. So, you know, so it's essentially like age-time state type calculation, if you know what time state is. Because in ages produce states. For example, those of us who are in semiconductor physics know that ages produce mid-gap states. It's very well known. So this is really arising from physics like that. The physics is very simple. You do not need any current or conductivity to have age accumulation. You just need a state. And this is related to that. Okay? And the problem is that, you know, this Berife's argument has problems, although it's very elegant. Experiment first is measuring just spin accumulation. That's the first problem. So if you want to compare with experiment, it's better to skip the step that Gerrit was questioning, that can you uniquely get a spin conductivity from spin accumulation? Okay? So if you can skip that, that's good. So this is all. These are slides Viktor provided me. So these are his opinion, but I agree with them. So there is a large gap between experiment, which measures a spin density, and the Berife's approach, which calculates spin current. An important question is, what is the connection between them, if any? So these are problems of spin current that I have already mentioned to you, and they are summarized here. Spin is not conserved. There is no continuity equation. Okay? There is no obvious relation between spin Hall current and observables. People are not measuring spin Hall current. And then, theoretically, this concept of Fermi surface Berife phase is a beautiful concept. Simply doesn't apply the moment the system is disordered. Okay? It applies only in the clean, perfectly clean band system. Well, in perfectly clean band system, you do not have transport. There is no conductivity there. So this Berife phase argument, to me, is a red herring. Okay, look at the argument, and you conclude this is all the bands are contributing. It's not a Fermi surface property at all. All the bands are contributing, you know, all the way deep. And so its connection to actual transport, all this very beautiful connection to actual transport, is very unclear to me. Okay? And this is work that will be published. I'm not even a co-author. Viktor Galitsky did it in his postdoc. He actually, for the Luttinger model, this paper they're writing up, Luttinger model, he explicitly showed that this spin Hall effect is very much like a Friedel oscillation, electric field-induced Friedel oscillation. I mean, he actually derived the formula for this Friedel oscillation. And this is not written up yet, so but there's some numerical results here. So I'm giving you a preview that they're writing the work. So let me now talk about the work in which I'm peripherally involved, and it's well-defined. You have disordered spin-coupled system, and you're looking at spin diffusion, and we want to calculate spin accumulation directly. Okay? So We all know that so we are doing hydrodynamics. So if things are slowly varying, this should be okay. Again, I think people of goodwill could disagree whether this, to what extent this model applies to actual experiments. But this is where one has to start. The work is completely analytical and totally beyond my ability to do is Viktor Galitsky's work. So basically, we have a diffusion equation for spin density. And what Viktor would do is to do a systematic gradient expansion on it because things are slowly varying. Okay? It's a classic technique of theoretical physics. So you need a hierarchy of length scales, and I'm going to come back to this hierarchy of length scales in a minute, but the basic idea is very simple. You have some spin relaxation momentum because of momentum-dependent spin dynamics. Diffusion is randomizing momentum, and it's going to spin relaxation, and you're going to now go do approximation on this diffusion pole propagator. So let me first tell you the regime of validity, because this is quite crucial. Viktor doesn't want me to overclaim the result, and so this slide is important. So you're doing a gradient expansion. Since you're doing a gradient expansion, this has to be valid. Never mind what those quantities are. The formal regime of validity for our theory is this, that the spin orbit coupling strength should be larger. So the system should be diffusive. So EF tau should be very, very large. But EF tau is very, very large, then this should be small. And spin orbit coupling should be sufficiently large so that this condition is satisfied. This condition is not easy to satisfy in reality. But for our theory, we need that. This is, in principle, easy, and this is, in principle, easy also. But you know, you have three independent quantities, EF, tau, and spin orbit coupling, and you have to satisfy three independent conditions, so theoretically it's consistent. But this condition is not quite satisfied in experiment. It's certainly not much, much larger than, they're kind of comparable, okay?
What does it mean physically, that condition?
It's basically condition means spin orbit coupling should be strong compared to diffusion. So, of course, if EF tau is going to infinity, this is automatically satisfied, you know? So EF should be large, okay? But, for example, if EF and tau, if tau is very, very large, okay? This is a condition of spin orbit coupling being large compared with diffusion scale. That's what it is, okay?
Let's see. On the right side, you say it's spin orbit should be large compared to the broadening, which means that the bands are resolved, right?
That's correct.
Well, that's clear.
Right.
Left one, why is this left one necessary?
You'll see, because why is necessary? Physical reason I cannot give, but this is the mathematical approximation you have to make. This is not, I'm not claiming this to be a physical constraint. This is a formal regime of validity. This is where we can do the analytic theory. Okay. Now, in principle, of course, you can satisfy it because if you go to a strongly diffusive regime, make EF tau very, very large, then this quantity is going to be very, very small, so there is no problem. Okay. But when you look at the experimental numbers, it's kind of barely satisfied. Certainly not much, much larger than. Okay. So then what you do is that you have the diffusion equation, and you have a kernel for the diffusion equation, an integral, and you just expand that kernel then systematically. It's easier said than done, because there are many, many, many terms that come in, and you have to keep track of all those terms, and Viktor did that very carefully, and when you do that, you find that, you know what we are doing? We are deriving the boundary conditions for spin. So we are not putting the boundary conditions for spin by hand. So you are assuming some boundary conditions. You have now eigenvalue condition for the problem. So it's a cubic equation, so these are the eigenvalue conditions. Because you have charge diffusion, you have spin diffusion, and you get these three equations. Okay? And all the parameters are known. But it's okay, you have these equations, you need boundary conditions, solve them. So you now need appropriate number of boundary conditions. How many boundary conditions do you need? Well, you have two amplitude, three spin component, three phase shift, it's 9. Okay? Diffusion equation will apply for three eigenvectors provided 6 relations, so you need 3 more. So 6 are automatic, we need 3 more. So boundary conditions are missing equations. Where do those boundary conditions come from? Well, now you have to solve the problem of half space, you have to solve the Schrodinger equation. So when you solve Schrodinger equation, what do? You set the boundary, either you have a short boundary, infinite edge, or you have a slowly varying boundary, you do WKB. You tell me what you want to do. I'll solve the problem for that boundary condition. So what I'm emphasizing here, spin boundary conditions do not tend to be put in by hand. Once you assume something about the charge boundary condition, a Schrodinger equation, since spin and charge are coupled, it automatically defines the spin boundary condition. This actually was kind of very vaguely understood by Rajba. You know, if you read his papers, he doesn't put it in this clear language. This is formally done. So what we are saying, what is explicitly done here, is that now we are going to solve, we are going to say, okay, what is your boundary condition for the charge? So we'll solve the problem for two separate boundary conditions. One for completely opaque, that means an infinite square well, boundary, another one semi-transparent or something like that, WKB. But, you know, realistically, it could be some other boundary condition, then you have to do the thing numerically.
Yeah. No,
that automatically included, because spin and charge are coupled. Now, we are not giving any mean spin dynamics to the boundary, but spin precession is completely included. Okay, so if you have some impurities with spin at the boundary, we can include that in our equation. Right now, we don't have that. But the fact that spin precession changes at the boundary reflection is automatically incorporated, if that's what you're thinking.
So the boundary goes back, your spin doesn't change.
That's what we're assuming. But if you think there is some other spin mechanism at the boundary, which you have, we can include that. In absence of that, we saw no reason to include that, but we can include that, is what I'm saying, okay? But the thing is that, the nice thing here is that the charge boundary condition automatically determines the spin boundary condition, which is the way it should be. You should not have two sets of boundary conditions. You should have just one set of boundary condition for your Schrodinger equation. And once you have... Yeah.
You have rough boundary.
Right, right.
This, of course, does conserve your charge.
Mm-hmm. Right. All of this does not conserve spin. Spin precession part is completely included here. Now, what you're saying is that if we do not quite know what the charge boundary condition at the surface is, let's say we do not know the charge boundary condition, then we cannot solve this problem. Okay? Well, you have to tell me exactly what you mean by rough. What is happening to the wave function? This is a one electron problem. Okay?
Yeah, but if you rough that, sort of, you have sort of multiple scattering of the electrons at the interface before it comes back, so
right.
The probability is 1.
Right.
You don't know what happens to the spin, and that would effectively be a spin sink, right?
That will be a spin sink. This was related to what he was asking.
But also Rushdie was using, right, in his...
Okay, so maybe there is a communication thing here. That effect is incorporated here. Okay, that effect is really incorporated here, that the spin precession may change. But suppose you have a bunch of magnetic impurities at the surface.
No, I think Rushdie had in one of his papers,
right.
He said, okay, let's assume that the interface is a spin sink.
Yes.
Spin current goes in and doesn't go out.
That we do not have. But we can easily put that in. So if it's a spin sink, that means you have some kind of magnetic scattering there, you know, something. If that, you have to tell me what that is, then we can put that in, okay? So let me just show you the results, what we get, since time is running out, and I just wanted to give you a flavor. There is a lot of mathematics here. So let me just show you the two. So two boundary conditions we did, a transparent boundary condition and impenetrable boundary condition. So transparent is things go smoothly, and impenetrable is infinite square well. In both cases, we can explicitly solve the problem, and you have a boundary spin charge coupling, and then there are higher order terms. So we solved everything up to order alpha. And we can then calculate the spin accumulation. Okay, so this is what it looks like. What we do not have, we do not know the connection between this spin accumulation and what is called spin Hall effect. Spin Hall effect is intrinsically incorporated in this whole theory because you're solving the diffusion equation precisely. But we have not been able to take some simple piece from standard spin Hall effect theory and say, ha, this is what you have to do. Now, very recently, like this week, there is a paper, I thought that was here, by Kleiman. Okay, it's not here. There is a paper posted, I think, on Monday by somebody named Kleiman, who has taken this theory, just this theory, and he claims to have gone to the next order, or alpha square. And he finds cancellations, which are rather magical. I really have no comment on it, but this next order term, I think there are like something like 900 terms in next order. He's somewhere from Europe, I don't remember. Kleiman.
Right.
Previous time, I thought that we mentioned this. Yeah, yeah. Bleibom. Sorry, I'm sorry, I got the name. Never. Where is he? I don't know the name.
He's from Magdeburg.
Okay, so I do not know who he is. I mean, I saw the paper, but I didn't read it. He claims to have gone to the next order. He claims to have calculated these terms. Okay. He just took our theory and said, well, this is very important, so one needs to calculate the next order. Victor has done the next order calculation, and I have gone through it. Every time you do it, you get a slightly different result because there's so many hundreds of terms that we cannot be sure. And he is claiming some answer which I think is correct. Then, in some sense, he's recovering the Rushdie result, but I do not know if it's correct or not. It's very recent. And so leading order, this is what we are getting, and I think this is fairly important. All this connection experiment, I'm not sure about. It's fairly important because this is the only theory I know that is parameter free and does not use the word spin current anywhere or spin Hall effect anywhere. It directly calculates what needs to be calculated for a spin accumulation. So results for electric field induced spin accumulation consistent the prediction of spin current theory, but quantitative comparison is difficult. Consistent meaning, yes, we get a spin accumulation. Okay. In clean system, the effect of spin accumulation is similar to Friedel oscillations, which decay as a power law. The net spin accumulation is non-zero due to localized edge state. This is a time state type thing. In disordered systems, spin accumulation depends on the structure of the edges. This is what we are discussing, and may occur without bulk spin current. It may arise entirely from the edge. Generally, the solution is a simple form like this, but the details will depend on the order. And so these are the problems and questions. So is the parameter eta, which is the spin charge coupling in the boundary, related to the spin Hall conductivity? If yes, then sigma is actually little determined this eta, but we have not been able to establish this connection. I think this is important. If this connection could be established, then we are giving a microscopic theory for spin Hall conductivity. Is the perturbation theory applicable to boundary problems? You know, this is a very important question. Our theory is still formally correct, but if the perturbation theory doesn't apply, then we should not compare our theory with experiment at all. You know, which may affect, and some of these questions were coming up. How does the additional boundary spin orbit coupling, okay, affect the boundary conditions, which of course you did not include? Our spin orbit coupling is just whatever you have in the bulk, Rajba. This boundary effect may completely spear out the bulk physics. We don't know. It's possible. Okay, this is to some extent what Gerrit was asking, and does the diffusion approximation apply? Theoretically, this is not a problem, but comparing the experiment is a problem. Okay, I think this is all I have for this part. Amazingly, I finished in an hour. But I will take questions. I know I went somewhat fast, obviously, for very good reason. I wanted to give a flavor. All of this is on the con mat, so you can all read. By the way, this one also, referees is very uninteresting, because Rajba has done it all, apparently. I mean, I'm not making it up. Two referees is completely uninteresting. One study should not even be published.
I didn't understand. Why is the boundary problem a perturbation theory, I guess?
No, perturbation is not a diffusion pole. Perturbation is that this gradient expansion. Okay, you know, it's the usual thing. If things depend on one point, and that point things are changing very fast, things may not apply. But the usual argument to use that things depend on some integral. Okay. So that's what one is saying. It is a perturbation theory in the spin orbit coupling. We have only up to leading, you know, we are not calculating terms up to alpha square. We are, everything that I showed you is the leading order. That's the expansion. That's, maybe I didn't explain it very well. This, okay, this is what we mean by perturbation theory. Okay, this is what we mean by perturbation theory.
Yeah, so I'm still quite to understand what this left one doesn't say.
Well, I mean, Victor is being just very careful. That suppose you could say that, you could say that when you have a boundary, you cannot do perturbation theory. There's some singular effect. I mean,
yeah, but this is standard, I guess.
This is very standard.
Absolutely standard.
I mean, he's just being extra careful.
And you're matching if you have sharp
Schrodinger equation,
you have to go to
absolutely. That's all you're doing. Now, Victor is being very careful, because I think he was a bit taken aback by the referee's reactions. So all he's saying is that suppose there is some singularity imposed by age, there is some bound state which just makes the whole perturbation theory invalid. I mean, this is not something we know. I think it's complete nonsense. I think this part is not needed at all. But he wants me to put all the caveats in. Since it's his theory, I saw no reason to put that out. He's just being, I mean, if you know him, then you'd know he's an incredibly careful guy. I mean, very, very reluctant to make claims. And so I agree with you that this is not a particularly sensible constraint. I mean, this is routinely done in diffusive perturbative theory. I think that this is what two of you are asking me, is a, you know, more serious issue. But in principle, if you know what the boundary is doing, it can be incorporated. But one in general doesn't know what boundary is. I mean, the nice thing about this theory of Viktor Galitsky is that it gives a formalism now, where you do not have to work with ill-defined quantities like spin Hall conductivity, spin current, but the bad thing is that you have to do some serious theoretical work. You know, very serious. These are very difficult calculations. I mean, and numerically also they're not easy, because you're dealing with 9 coupled integral differential equations. You know, 9 coupled integral differential equation is not a trivial thing. Yes?
So you derive this spin diffusion equations for the bulk.
Yes.
And so you say that if you look at them, you cannot identify anything which can be
right.
Called as spin current.
Correct. That's exactly what you're saying. We don't see anything in our theory, you know, this hundreds of period algebra which can be identified as spin current. Yeah, that doesn't mean it's not there. Somebody clever may say, okay, if you combine this with that, then that's what people are talking about spin current. I mean, my hope was that something like spin current will come out of this naturally. It doesn't. And that, I think, is a matter of concern.
The bulk problem you have solved, I think, basically gave the same result as Nischenko and Burkov had, right?
No, their boundary conditions are different.
Well, yeah, boundary, right. They did not address boundary conditions at all.
Sure, they're looking at diffusion equation also. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. No, no, Bart, when he was here, sat down with me for half a day and then sat down with Victor for one whole day. Bart agrees that the boundary conditions, what you're doing is the, you know, it's not obvious, but what needs to be done. The bulk is, yes. Yeah.
Does that mean that you can then write what is the spin current in the bulk?
Well, that is something that reasonable people could conclude, yes. Because it's not something that naturally arises. But I mean, just because it doesn't show up here doesn't mean you cannot write it. But it's not showing up here for sure.
I think I'm asking just a much simpler question.
Right.
So if your bulk equations agree with Alper and he has expressions for spin current, right? So you also have the same expression for something which people call the spin current.
Yeah.
So then you can compare the expression for spin current. We calculated the accumulation. Do they?
No, but that's where you have to stop. Because to go to accumulation from that quantity, you have to have some boundary conditions.
Yeah, sure, but you have boundary conditions. You calculated the...
We do not have boundary conditions. Our boundary conditions fall from the theory. We do not impose boundary condition on spin at all. That's the whole point. Our boundary conditions, standard boundary conditions for Schrodinger equation itself, which is, you know, that the amplitude vanishes and...
I'm just saying that you know the right answer.
Okay. All right, so the answer is that we disagree with them. Okay. Very strongly. Okay, that's the answer. I mean, I know that's what you're getting at. I was trying to avoid giving you the answer, but yes. And you have sat down and agreed that you disagree, and Holpein at least agrees that they did not calculate the boundary condition. And there is another paper by Malkunov or somebody, that's PRO from Sweden, where Malshukov and Chow, they kind of claim they calculated boundary conditions. And their boundary conditions are different from ours. They just put down some. So we communicated with them, and they told us that they really didn't calculate it. They just, you know, thought this is very reasonable. And we communicated with them extensively. We sent them all our notes, all our calculations, saying that, look, since we are getting a different result, see if there is some... Yeah, so we contacted these two groups extensively. I mean, it's still, you know, very active area. Victor would have several papers. Yes, Nitin.
In the expression that you get for the spin Hall conductivity.
Yes. This is the first part, first stuff you're talking about. Right.
And it involves things like the Fermi energy and the mobility of the sample.
Right.
And you've said that, okay, if you put in the numbers in rough agreement with the experiment,
right.
But what about trends? So
trends?
If you go to a dirtier sample, whereas you go to a more highly doped sample.
I did not have private discussion with Oshalam, so I do not know all the details of what it is. I just went to his published results. We published the trends agree also, except for the sign caveat, which presumably we have solved by our second paper. Okay? And no strain dependence, for example, is again consistent with impurities. You know. So I think right now there is no claim that the Santa Barbara experiments could be intrinsic. There was a claim from Stanford, but I think, I mean, you need to ask the Stanford people, but I think that claim they themselves have kind of withdrawn. That's my understanding. Joel?
You made a comment about these very phase derivations of the anomalous Hall calculation, but I thought that the point of what Hall had been doing was that you could put everything in terms of Fermi surface properties.
That's for anomalous Hall effect, not for spin Hall effect.
Right, but anomalous effect, that means very phase derivation, even though it
absolutely.
It looks like it
absolutely.
Generalize, you don't have that.
Absolutely.
But then, once it's pushed to the Fermi
right.
Surface, then you can...
There is absolutely no problem in anomalous Hall effect. Everything I said is for spin Hall effect. You cannot generate the Berry phase argument of the Texas group to disordered system.
Okay.
Because that's there are all the bands come in, and I had a long discussion with Duncan, and he said...
What I wonder is, how is what Duncan has done consistent with what Mosier's... you mentioned this paper, Mosier's consider in the absence of the intrinsic analysis.
Yeah, I have not tried to translate the language. Mosier, of course, was going with the corpus Luttinger, where the word Berry phase was never mentioned. You know, it's a good question that It's a good question. I don't have an answer. I did not go back and see, because Duncan's paper is crystal clear, how that reconciles with Nozier and Leavener's conclusion. One should be able to do that. Both are analytical paper. So I don't have a good answer to that. But it's a good question. When I said the Berry phase arguments do not quite apply, I was talking about spin Hall effect. Okay? Because there all the bands contribute, and the moment you have disorder, and Duncan knows that, because Duncan did it 2 years ago when I was here. And I told him, can't you do spin Hall effect? He said, no, because all the bands are contributing. I don't know how to convert that into just a Fermi surface quantity, you know. So, but you asked a good question. I mean, it's something maybe, you know, we should look at. Okay. Yeah. Should you take a break? Or? I don't need a break. I mean, I'm already very grateful that you guys are here. So I know Nitin would definitely want to listen to the second part, and so Joel. This is now I told you how everybody's wrong in spin Hall effect, and I'll tell you everybody's wrong in ferromagnetic semiconductor. A lot of fun, since everybody is not here. No, it's going to be her. Yeah. So then we'll not take a break. We'll just continue, and then people want to leave, they will just leave. It's structured, it's modular. And so when your part is done, you can just leave. Yeah, I need to learn how to clean up the thing, but I find it easier to just put everything on the desktop, and it works well for me. Then the folder, I mean, I see someone like Charlie Marcus, folder within folder within folder within folder, you know, when he opens something, it's like you're waiting, when he's going to get there? Mine everything. All right, so I want to talk about ferromagnetic semiconductors, and what do you really know? And I really have a very different viewpoint, I have to emphasize this. Very different viewpoint from at least one of the talks I heard earlier, Thomas Jungwirth, who really claimed, and you know, some of you are here, that everything is more or less understood. It's only things at the edge not understood, some details not understood. I really believe somewhat, if I'm going to take an extreme view, then the reverse may be true. Okay, that some of the things are understood, most things are not understood, from a theoretical viewpoint. Okay, and I'll tell you the questions that come up. Okay, what do you really know? For example, is it carrier mediated? Well, for gallium, manganese, arsenide, we all agree it's carrier mediated. But that's one of 10 materials, or maybe 15 materials, in which people have claimed to see ferromagnetic semiconductors. As a theorist, I would like to know, is it a generic phenomenon? Or is it like anybody who does some sample, sees something and makes a claim? Or is it like some of them are okay, some of them are not? This is a job of theorists, and I think there is no answer to that. Well, let's say carrier mediated. Let's talk about gallium, manganese, arsenide. Which carriers? You know, there were two earlier talks this week. One, I was absolutely sure it's valence band. Second one, because I tricked Nitin, who felt it's impurity band. I mean, he didn't know the talk before, so that's why people laughed when I asked, okay? But you know, it's a very legitimate question, that if you're going to, probably in reality neither is true, it's something intermediate, sometimes valence band, sometimes impurity band. But if you're going to take an extreme view, effective model, which is what I'll be working with, which one is more appropriate? Or is it different for different experiments? Intrinsic versus extrinsic. This is not so important for gallium, manganese, arsenide, because as far as I know, everybody believes the ferromagnetism to be intrinsic there. But take something like cobalt titanium oxide, where the TC is claimed to be 1000 Kelvin. It seems intrinsic and extrinsic are both playing roles there. Some of the ferromagnetic people see it extrinsic, meaning it's just a clustering of cobalt, or clustering of cobalt at surface, and some of it may be intrinsic. So intrinsic versus extrinsic becomes an important question, and even in gallium, manganese, arsenide, some of the properties that we see experimentally may be connected to extrinsic behavior, not really carrier-mediated ferromagnetism. And related to that, there are all these various defects. Are they part of intrinsic phenomena, or are they extrinsic? If you can make the material better and better, are they all going to go away? Or if you make the material better, maybe the ferromagnetism will disappear. Maybe compensation is absolutely crucial. So this is an important question. Connected with this impurity versus valence band, question of localized versus itinerant. I don't want to confuse you. Often people who believe all the physics is valence band use two statements synonymously. They use the statement valence band versus impurity band is the same as itinerant versus localized. This is completely false. I want to emphasize. You can have a metallic impurity band which goes into an insulating impurity band. So the fact that Nitin Samarth in his experiments finds his material to be quote-unquote metallic, very weak temperature dependence or no temperature dependence, is not support for valence band carriers, okay? Because you can certainly have impurity band. In fact, if Nitin tries to measure the mass by some technique, chances are he's going to find very large mass, much larger than valence band mass in gallium arsenide. So in that sense, one can even claim that's more consistent. So localized versus itinerant is a different question from valence band versus impurity band. Because you can have both localized and itinerant electrons in a hole in a valence band, and You can have both localized and itinerant holes in an impurity band. Then there is this question of RKKY versus double exchange. It's again a red herring because they're the same model, both are condo model, both are PD exchange model, and depending on whether you're in the strong coupling regime, it's called double exchange, weak coupling regime, it's called RKKY, it's exactly the same thing. So it's really, it's again a distinction without a difference. And a large fraction of the community, influenced by Dittel's early work, uses mean field RKKY. So even if you agree RKKY is good, well, mean field RKKY is a big jump from RKKY. I certainly hope it's not all mean field RKKY. You know why? Because if all mean field RKKY, I'm wasting my time in this field. Because you don't need theorists then. There's nothing for theorists to do, okay, if it's mean field RKKY. Meaning theorists like me, Bansucker theorists may still have a role to play. Then disorder plays a very important role. As you know, disorder and magnetism is an old subject, very important area, and not much is understood. There could be Griffith's phrase, there is frustration, so there could be glassy phases, and nobody denies that there is disorder in these systems. Nitin Samad's very good sample, once I asked him what is the mobility, and he wanted to wiggle out, I said, no, tell me the mobility. Mobility is low. It's of the order of 1, or 2, or 10, or 50. Now, to give you an idea, in same units, quantum Hall experiments are done in samples with 10 million or 30 million mobility, and silicon MOSFETs, even at room temperature, have mobility of the order of 1,000, 200 to 1,000. So, you know, these may be metals, but these are metals with very high disorder. If you convert the measured mobility into a mean free path, it's of the order of a lattice constant. That means your Fregel criterion will tell you that these systems are really insulators, okay? So disorder must be playing a very important role. Phase diagram. If you have disorder and magnetic interaction, there should be other non-ferromagnetic phases. NF means non-ferromagnetic, which is not necessarily a paramagnet. There could be glassy phases, there could be spin glass, there could be other kind of glass. Valence bond glass, like a singlet, you know, frozen liquid. Very interesting phase, much more interesting than ferromagnetic phase, from my perspective, since I know these things are not going to be used ever anyway. So. Now, TC itself depends on so many parameters. I wrote down some of those parameters. Effective coupling, even with an effective theory. Let's say somehow you can extract one coupling parameter, one exchange coupling. Then you have carrier density, magnetic moment density. There is direct antiferromagnetic exchange between two manganese with their nearest neighbor. Very strong and very short range. Clearly that will play a role. All the details of band structure may play a role. Spin orbit coupling in the bands may play a role, disorder will play a role. So there could easily be 15 parameters determining in TC. So I myself am completely opposed to getting this agreement between experiment and theory. When you have 15 parameters, you can fit anything. Okay, so one should be very cautious about this agreement between experiment and theory. Once you see how many unknown parameters there are. All of these parameters are unknown, with the possible exception of band structure. So, do you have percolation playing an important role here? Is the transition a percolation transition? And then you can ask a whole host of questions, many of which have been asked. Is ferromagnetism collinear? Do you have glassy phases? Do you have clustering? You know, mean field at various levels, how good are they? Virtual crystal approximation, are they good? So, when I say, what do you really know? I would like to know the unique answers to all these questions, or all these issues, for all the materials. And I would say that if you put the question in this broad manner, and take all the materials, then let's say, you know, multiply these questions with all the materials, so you have 100 questions, let's say, or a couple of hundred questions, actually a few percent of them have been answered. So I would say we know very little. Okay? We of course know much more about gallium manganese arsenide than some of the other materials. But even for gallium manganese arsenide, we do not know much. So you know, this is a big branch of spintronics, having good ferromagnetic semiconductor. This is one of the push. I mean, I remember the early days, 1999, Nitin Samat was in the field longer than me. You know, the fact that finally dilute magnetic semiconductors exist with intrinsic Curie temperature approaching room temperature, Hideo Ono's work is what pushed the field forward, DARPA program and so on. And then, of course, spin devices and spin qubits are other parts, but this is what I'm going to talk about now. So, essentially, we want to talk about how to make semiconductors ferromagnetic, and can you tune magnetic properties by controlling carrier densities. Semiconductors are great. You don't make transistors with metals because you cannot control metallic properties by tuning metallic density. Metallic density is just too high. Semiconductors are great because you can control semiconducting properties by external electric field. So if you can control both magnetic and transport properties by applying external electric field, then you're talking about logic, memory, all these things. That's why we want to combine magnetic and semiconductor properties. Okay? And this work is actually done all with postdocs, with the exception of Andy Millis, who is a professor at Columbia. So Pryor is still at Maryland, living in a in a few days. Kaminsky was at Maryland, Galitsky is coming back as a professor, Zhang left, Huang is still there. This is pretty difficult work, and we have worked on many aspects of it. So this is, they did not all work on the same problem, but it's something that I have not had students work on because it's a difficult subject for students. There is no well-defined problem. So these are some examples of ferromagnetic semiconductors, and then there's oxides. I'll not say much about oxides. So, you know, there are various questions, query temperature, domain dynamics, physical properties, because if you're going to use them for anything, you've got to know all these things. So we all know how to make semiconductors ferromagnetic, right? Dope semiconductors with magnetic impurities. So you take gallium arsenide, dope it with manganese, hard to do, but if you can do it, you will have a ferromagnet. Same, you take titanium oxide, dope it with cobalt, if you can do it, you'll have a ferromagnet. If you can do it and get a bulk homogeneous material, you'll have a ferromagnet. Very hard to do because you have to do low temperature non-equilibrium MBE. This is an old figure from Ono. Results have changed a little bit, but not qualitatively for my purpose. I like this figure. So what is being plotted here is Curie temperature, gallium manganese arsenide, each different sample, unfortunately, as a function of manganese concentration. Now I should emphasize, none of these things is known very well. Manganese concentration is known nominally. You do not know all of them are magnetically active. So one needs to take all of these things with a grain of salt. So everything is qualitative here. So what in this early experiment was found, Matsukura et al., is that at first, TC goes up. In those days, this was the record, 110, and then TC comes down. The open symbols, the system is localized, insulating, and the closed symbols, the system is metallic. So it was established that the metallic gallium manganese arsenide will have optimal TC, but insulating gallium manganese arsenide is also ferromagnetic. It's a continuous phenomena. So if you have a theory that works just here and fails completely here, I would not call that understanding. You need to have a theory that kind of, you know, gives you something in both ends. Now, more modern results, and Nitin can correct me if I'm wrong, it looks like it goes up and then kind of becomes a plateau, and then eventually, of course, it will come down. So this going down, materials improvement, you know, this has gone up to, as you know, 170. In 2006, you have something like 170, and instead of it's coming down, it's more like a plateau, with maybe slightly going down trend, but it's not coming down this sharply. So let's look at transport. So there is correlation between transport and magnetic properties. Here is gallium manganese arsenide. This figure is taken from the same paper as this paper. And these three that you see here, which are metallic, resistivity as a function of temperature, are not showing. This is exponential, by the way. This is log scale. So this constant is a bit misleading. It's not, you know, it's changing by a factor of two or three. It's not an ordinary metal, but it's constant compared to this. These are insulating. It's becoming exponentially growing. So these are the three, these three points. So it's non-monotonic. This is 0.1, this is 1%, 2%, 7% are insulating, and 3%, 4%, 5% are metallic, and 3%, 4%, 5% are these three, 1%, 2%, and 7% are these. So these are the kind of things you want to understand. This is germanium manganese result. These are all insulating, it seems, but they have some metallic samples also, and these are also ferromagnetic. So the first statement I want to make, both metallic and insulating materials are ferromagnetic. Metallic seems to have higher TC. So the basic model for this that you should all know, we have had so many talks on this, is that you have some effective coupling between the manganese moments, the magnetic impurity, the large S, with the hole moment, local exchange called PD coupling here. It's this is the famous SD coupling in lanthanides and materials like that. And this PD coupling leads to an effective coupling between magnetic moments. So what is happening is that you have this magnetic manganese moments, localized impurity moments, and you have the holes which carry small spin. So there is coupling between the hole spin and the manganese moment, and that coupling is mediated to another manganese moment. So these two manganese moments talk to each other through the holes. And when they talk to each other through the holes, there could be ordering because of this indirect exchange coupling. Okay, I emphasize this direct exchange coupling between two manganese also, that's short-ranged, and this is long-ranged. Okay, that's if they're itinerant. And so the order and for small x, and typically what one finds is the carrier density is much, much lower than the impurity density. In gallium manganese arsenide, manganese is both an acceptor, a donor, and a manganese moment. So you'd expect them to be equal, but often it's found to be 10% or 20%. So there is heavy compensation, and there is strong antiferromagnetic exchange. So what is the Hamiltonian? We should start with the system Hamiltonian as theories. It's very complicated. It's the Hamiltonian for every problem basically in condensed matter physics. This is the Hamiltonian for cuprates, this is the Hamiltonian for manganites, this is the Hamiltonian for condylarthritis problem. So kinetic energy, you have the, you know, all Coulomb interaction I'm putting in here, including the Coulomb interaction with manganese and the lattice potential. So this is the this is the non-interacting term, this is the band term. Then you have disorder, because you have disorder coming not only from manganese, there could be other disorder. So this is the disorder potential, very important. Then you have the basic Kondo coupling between the manganese moment and the hole or carrier spin, okay? And then you have direct antiferromagnetic exchange coupling between the manganese moments themselves. So the only term I did not write here explicitly, I should have had another term, which is the Coulombic coupling between the manganese acceptor and the holes. So think of there being a one electron Coulombic term here also. So this problem, of course, you cannot solve exactly. Okay, depending on your taste, you need to put one or other as important. Okay, and you'll see, yeah. What interaction? That is presumably in this term, because I do not take into account anyway. So I'm going to do only effective theory. I myself will do only effective theory. So spin orbit interaction, this is the band term. So band term I can keep on writing and adding things, okay?
But there you should take basically the
Lottinger. Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm writing it as microscopic band term, even before Lottinger, okay? But you're absolutely right. So this band term includes, so this is the periodic potential, which says Coulomb potential, this is Coulomb potential due to the ions, is what it means, okay? So all that is included here, okay, in principle. So if you want to do band structure, you'll emphasize this, and this will be just some minor term. If you do effective theory, then this is the term that you are most interested in, and so on. If you're interested in frustration, you'll keep this and this. So there are various things that you have to take into account. So let me tell you, with my favorite phase diagram, some of you may have seen before, this is the schematic. So I have two parameters that are important, carrier density and impedance density. I'm going to think of them as independent quantities. If I think of them as independent quantities, then I immediately realize that this problem, this Hamiltonian, has been studied to death by the theoretical physics community in various regimes. This regime is called Kondo problem, when the carrier density is very high and you have just one impurity or few impurities. This is called Kondo problem. If you go over there, where you have one impurity per site, that's called Kondo lattice. Again, enormous amount of work has been done there. If you include disorder, then this regime, the regime of few impurities but a lot of carriers, is called spin glass. Okay, that's the RKKY spin glass. Whether there is a spin glass or not is still being debated, so quote unquote. Now, we are lucky as theorists that all the smart people who are interested in Kondo problem, Kondo lattice spin glass, never looked at this regime. Regime where the carrier density is much, much lower than impurity density. Okay, they all looked there, and we are lucky that all the smart people looked over here, because if they looked here, this problem would be solved a long time ago. Okay, and it was actually solved a long time ago. I'll come back to that. Okay. The thing that is known as Dirac formula was derived by Abrikosov and Gorbachev in 1962, and exactly the same formula is given in their paper. Okay, so this regime had impurity density much, much larger than carrier density because of compensation. And this is the only regime where you can have ferromagnetism, because the frustration is not very strong. But if you make the impurity density very high, you have direct antiferromagnetic exchange, so antiferromagnetic material comes in. This phase diagram is just a projection, because you really have many other parameters. It's a multi-dimensional phase diagram. You have coupling strength, you have antiferromagnetic coupling strength, disorder, temperature, you could have reentrant transition. And you know, this whole part of regime that's not known, and I'm going to fill in some of them. And the theorist's job, effective theorist, I'm an effective theorist, effective field theorist, I'm not interested in one point here and doing big band structure calculations to find out what's going on. I really want to know what the topology of the phase diagram is, and I'll fill in some of it as I go along. So the theories I'll talk about are the most simple theory, RKKY virtual crystal approximation mean field theory. Then I'm going to improve that somewhat. So I'm going to take spatial impurity fluctuations into account, do a thermal mean field theory. Then I'm going to do exact Monte Carlo RKKY. This paper was posted yesterday. Then I'm going to talk about DMFT double exchange. And if time permits, I'll talk about it, but I suspect time will not permit, talking about bound magnetic polaron percolation. So the basic mean field theory, virtual crystal approximation, is very simple. You assume the system to be a continuum. You assume that there is no fluctuations. Although there is disorder, you assume that disorder can be considered to be a jelly, so it's called virtual crystal approximation. So there is no disorder at all. You have a uniform homogeneous medium, and you do a mean field theory, the standard Weiss mean field theory. Okay? It will fail for large value of any of your parameters, but this is where you have to begin. So if you begin there, then you have to ask, okay, you can have a degenerate system, as will be itinerant system, extended metallic system, or you can have a non-degenerate system where the electrons are localized, carriers are localized, and the system is insulating. You can do Weiss mean field theory for both. This was first done by Abrikosov and Gorkov in 1962, but in the wrong regime. They were over here. and they did a part of, they did a mean field theory here. And they were looking at this new material that has come out, cerium with some manganese mixed in it. And they said, oh, we want to understand the property of cerium manganese, it's going to be a ferromagnet. And the formula they wrote down is exactly the formula that's called Dickel formula today. It's identical. But of course, they were embarrassed because we all know that if you are here, you don't get a ferromagnet, you get a spin glass. So Abhikasam and Gaurkarabandil never really talked about it much. But when you are in this regime, their formula is correct. And I think it's unfair not to cite them, which community doesn't do, leave them out completely, because the whole formula, this formula that is now called Dittel formula, is in their paper in 1962. J square x cube root of n. It doesn't apply in this regime, but it certainly applies somewhere in this regime where the theory applies. So you can do mean field theory. It's really a just a small exercise. And if you do it, you find in degenerate system, the TC goes as J square x. J is the PD coupling, exchange coupling. X is the manganese impurity concentration. N is carrier density. And if you do the non-degenerate cases, go as J square root of X square root of N. This was first done by Off. This was first done by Abhikasam-Gorkov in the wrong regime, and then by Dittel in the correct regime. And Dittel also included spin orbit coupling. But this actually leaves out all these other questions that are important, and I'm going to discuss each of them one by one and stop at some time. So this is the outline of the mean field theory. It's very simple. Basically what you have is that it's a two-component mean field theory, because instead of having just an ordinary mean field theory, you have just one kind of magnetic moment. Now you have impurity magnetic moment and carrier spin. So basically you have a two-component mean field theory, and then you do two-component mean field theory, you have mean field theory in the large S, you have mean field theory in small s, and basically the kind of formulas you get are Brillouin function of Brillouin function. That's what you get. And so you get a Brillouin function inside another Brillouin function, but you can solve it. It's no big deal. It's really an undergraduate homework problem, okay? And you can solve it, and immediately comes out this formula, depending on whether you do degenerate or non-degenerate. And so the mean field theory is very nice, because it gives you a base to start from. It tells you that the TC should go up as J square, should go up linearly in X, and should go as cube root of N. And you can calculate the magnetization. Here is the formula for magnetization. You can calculate the spin polarization of the carriers. All these things you can calculate. Here is the mean field theory result. Nitin Samat left just as I was going to show his result. This is a result from Samat's group. And this is the mean field theory for result for magnetization, calculated numerically. This is spin polarization. And you see the magnetization could show very non-Brillouin-like behavior depending on the ratio of carrier density to impedance density. If carrier density and impedance density are equal, you see standard Brillouin function type behavior. But if the carrier density is much, much smaller than impedance density, you see very non-mean field-like behavior. But it's mean field theory, meaning non-standard mean field-like. Nothing particularly profound here, except the result could look very different. A more accurate, more powerful dynamical mean field theory gives results very similar. Here is experimental data. They anneal, presumably by annealing, they are going to higher values of this carrier density, and you see that for low values of when they do not anneal, it looks non-mean field type. In fact, some, I'll show you later results where they see concave structure also. So you see this very non-mean field like, looks very much like this result. And then when they anneal eventually, it becomes more and more mean field like, and the explanation is that they're annealing, carrier density is going up. So this mean field theory is very nice. It gives you a good zeroth order picture, but obviously if it's the whole story, we don't need theory. So the first refinement we made 2 years ago was to say, okay, this mean field theory is actually mean field theory. It's two kinds of mean field, right? In a thermal mean field, you are neglecting all thermal fluctuations, and you're also neglecting all spatial fluctuations, because the impedance is randomly located, and you're taking a jelly, you're making a virtual crystal approximation. So there are two kinds of averaging here. One averaging is that you're averaging about thermal fluctuations and neglecting that, but you're also neglecting spatial fluctuations. We said, well, spatial fluctuations are more important here because we're really not interested in critical exponents. We are interested in TC. TC should not be so bad in thermal fluctuations. We are wrong, but that's how we argued. So we said, we'll first correct the spatial fluctuations. We're going to do a theory which is still a thermal mean field theory, but you're going to take into account the exact crystal lattice structure of gallium arsenide and exact disorder of the magnetic impurities. This can be done basically analytically. Okay? And we published a couple of physical letters. This is very nice theory. I do not know why people didn't realize this before. And basically we put manganese randomly in this gallium arsenide lattice. And if you tell me that it's not random, Karsten Tim had some molecular dynamics simulations where he finds things are not random. Well, you tell me what the correlations are. I can put that in. You tell me what the manganese are, I'm going to put them in, I'm going to make no approximation about the spatial fluctuation. They're going to be included exactly. But I'm going to do straight thermal mean field theory. And so what we do is that we call this lattice mean field theory. So this is not a virtual crystal approximation. We replace individual spins with the thermally averaged and slight average polarization, but you retain the positional disorder in our model. I'm not going to give you the details of this theory because our new theory completely supersedes this. And this can be done. There are various length scales you have to worry about, which length scale, what happens. But let me just show you the results. Basically, we get very good agreement. I mean, we get excellent agreement, the bunch of papers on it, this thermal mean field theory. We can understand all little behavior in experimental details with, you know, reasonable parameters. But the problem is these parameters are not well known. I really disagree with one of the speakers earlier this week that the carrier density and the manganese impure density and the interstitial density and the anti-site density and the effective coupling, all these things are known. So you have four unknowns and you are fitting, you know, from one curve. I mean, you have to be very original not to get agreement. Okay, for unknowns. Okay, so the thing is that although we publish papers getting this agreement because referees force you to get these agreements, it's good. This agreement says that overall you are learning something. But whether this theory is refined enough to describe your physics completely, we do not know. Okay, so I really thought that this thermal mean field theory, lattice mean field theory, was a tremendous improvement. But then I had this bad feeling that we should know what the RKKY phase diagram is. So we are assuming the interaction is RKKY, okay? So you're not asking any question about what the interaction is. You're assuming that the two magnetic impurities really interact via RKKY interaction. And again, people could say, well, that's a bad model. But my style in physics has always been that once I make a model, I try to solve the problem fairly correctly. So you could question my model, but you cannot question my theory. So that's what you're trying to do here. So what we wanted to do is that given an RKKY model, can I tell you everything you want to know? And the answer today is yes, as of yesterday. And the answer is quite fascinating. Okay? So we calculate the phase diagram of the RKKY model. Amazingly, it has never been done in the regime. It has been done in the spin glass context, in the regime where the carrier density is much, much larger than the impurity density. That's where the spin glass people always work. And there's an enormous amount of work by Binder, Dasgupta, many other people in that regime, where the carrier density is much, much larger than the impurity density. Fortunately for us, it has never been looked at in the regime of interest for magnetic semiconductors. Carrier density equal or less than the impurity density. And I'm going to show you, this just got posted just a couple of days ago. So let me just show you the results. There are some, because you know these are experts, I don't need to tell you. So this is the model. This is our model. Magnetic impurities are interacting via RKKY interaction, and the interaction is RKKY, and we also include a cutoff with an adjustable parameter. This cutoff serves two purposes. One is that in the impurity band, you expect the interaction to look like this. You do not expect the interaction to just be oscillatory. It will be short range of the cutoff. This L, you can think of it as a mean free path, or you can think of it as localization length. It's a parameter. In fact, if you just take this L from mean free path, just one lattice constant, that's reasonable. So we are going to show results for both L infinity and L small. Okay. So this is our model. Our model, I want no argument on our model. This is our model. Very well-defined model. Okay?
That L can be there in the microscope.
Which one?
That L.
Yes. The L, no. L for our purpose is not derived microscopically. Yeah. It's some phenomenological parameter. Absolutely. In theoretical, you can definitely derive it microscopically. Absolutely. No question about it. Yes. Yes, it's a well-defined theoretical parameter. It is on the order of mean free path, okay? But it's not exactly mean free path, okay? But I'm really interested in the topology of the phase diagram and things like that, okay, at this stage. For that, it doesn't really matter. So this is our model. And so this is undamped RKKY, this is damped RKKY, depending on the value of L one is using. Of course, if L is very large, it would look like that. But for L of the order of lattice constant, this is what it looks like. So there are many length scales in the problem, right? Three length scales. You have the average impurity separation, you have the average carrier separation, and you have the cutoff length scale L. All, there are three independent length scales, and the problem is very rich. Your phase diagram is very rich because three independent length scales in the problem. Okay? Typically, of course, Li is much, much smaller than Lc because your carrier density is much, much smaller than the impurity density. So let me now just show you the we use the supercell technique, and we use this very effective heat bath technique of simulated annealing. And Donald Pryor, who did this calculation, is a world authority on Monte Carlo calculation. And these are really state of the art. We used a very large computer, took us a year and a half to do this. And you can, the results I'm giving you are the results for RKKY system. And amazingly, it was never done. And Donald did a very careful job and tested everything by increasing system size by factors of 100 to see that the phase line doesn't change. Okay. So the technical words are simulated annealing using heat bath technique. Other technical details are paper, let me just not talk about that. So locating phase boundary here is an art. Okay, so this is our Chi. You can see Chi has a very sharp feature, but if you just look at magnetization, it's well known in the finite system, it has these plateaus. But there are all kinds of fantastic techniques developed by Binder and his collaborators to identify, all of them from spin glass physics community, to identify phase line when you have this sort of thing. And we used all the set of glass techniques, which I'm not going to go into the details of. I want to show you the phase diagram. So let me ignore all the percolation arguments which are used in identifying the phase diagram and show you the phase diagram itself. So let's start with this. T is equal to zero phase diagram for dark AQI model. Don't be misled by the word T is equal to zero. I'm showing you classical phase diagram. So at T is equal to zero, this will not be valid. Some quantum fluctuations will take over. But that is really will happen very close to T is equal to zero. Quantum temperature here is like 100 millikelvin. So above quantum temperature, this is absolutely all right. So what we find...
Isn't there a direct dipole-dipole interaction that's maybe 10 kelvin? Obviously, it's dominated at 100 kelvin.
Direct dipole-dipole interaction between the manganese. It's not because they are far separated. So it's not 10 kelvin. Actually, that's something I'm very interested in.
Far separated, isn't that one of our cubes?
Yeah. No, we estimated it. It's of the order of a kelvin, but it's not 10. It's of the order of a kelvin. In fact, I'm very interested in that because I think that in some of these oxide materials, the ordering may be due to that. Okay, so we are doing a simulation of that also separately, but not in this problem. So we actually tested that. And these measurements are all at, But this is a very good point, and I'm very interested in the direct dipole-dipole interaction. Okay, we are simulating that right now to understand some other material. So the phase diagram, the important thing in the phase diagram is that by the time you reach carrier density over impedance density be 0.1, ferromagnetism disappears, period. Okay? So you do not have to go to 1. And this actually doesn't come as a surprise to anybody who has looked at frustrated ferromagnetic system. So if you take a Hamiltonian, which has been studied extensively in the spin glass literature, you take a Hamiltonian where the Hamiltonian is sum over Jij, Si, short range Hamiltonian, Si is J, and you say Jij nearest neighbor is ferromagnetic, Jij next nearest neighbor is antiferromagnetic, then by the time Jij antiferromagnetic is comparable to Jij ferromagnetic, all ferromagnetism disappears. This is very well studied for the last 20 years. So what I'm saying, the fact that ferromagnetism is very fragile here is not a surprise at all. Okay? Because you have this, so this is for L is equal to infinity. So for L is equal to infinity, it's very sharp. It doesn't really depend on manganese concentration. So this is a robust ferromagnetism. When you make L of the order of lattice constant, then of course it shifts because now the antiferromagnetism is suppressed. Okay? So of course, ordinary Curie-Weiss theory says that it's ferromagnetic everywhere and that TC keeps on going up. Okay, so we find that ferromagnetism is destroyed by the time you go to 0.1. Okay? Or if you have include damping, then somewhat larger. Experimentally, we have reached something around here, maybe 0.3. So what about TC? Well, here is TC. TC, for this situation, TC is high. Everything is in unit of J0. Here, you have robust ferromagnetism over a large regime. Let me go to the next picture where I have everything together here. So let me show you this one. So this is susceptibility, this is magnetization, but let's look at the phase diagram. So this is the phase diagram when you have, so it is indeed true that if you have a very clean system, TC will be very high. See, TC is about 5 times here than here. But the ferromagnetism has a very narrow regime. On the other hand, if you have a lot of scattering, if you have like very short mean free path, then ferromagnetism stabilizes over a very large regime, but TC is not very high. Now the actual magnitude of TC may vary, only 120 Kelvin here. We don't know what effective J is. So you have to be careful that you cannot say, well, this disagrees with experiment. It doesn't disagree with experiment. You don't know what the scale is. So the important point here is that if you have a lot of scattering, that will help you in having robust ferromagnetism over a large regime. On the other hand, if you want very high TC, then you have a very narrow regime of ferromagnetism. We see no way out of this if you have RKQI ferromagnetism. Okay? I mean, this is just, I think that if you are unabashed about it, think about it, you'll conclude that this must happen. Where it happens is a question of detail. Whether it happens on a 0.1 or 0.2 or 0.3 have to be a real calculation, which is what we have done. So, one possible explanation for the experimental observation is that experimentalists really have a system like this. So they are seeing robust ferromagnetism because there is a lot of scattering. and there is a large regime for your ferromagnetism, but then there's bad news, you'll not be able to raise TC much, which, as I emphasized, asking questions with the speakers you had earlier in the week, that they have not been able to raise TC. Remember, TC was 120 in 1998 in the very first experiment, and even after $25 million of DARPA money, TC has gone up to 170. So, you know, one, if you believe this sort of behavior, then it says that you're not going to raise TC much. If you're in ferromagnetism, a very large regime, increasing carrier density is going to do nothing to you. Okay? So what I'm saying is that I'm not going to claim that's what is going on, but this is not inconsistent experiment. This, I would say, is inconsistent experiment. But this is expected to be inconsistent experiment, because this system is not a perfect mirror by any means. It's much closer to this than to this. Now, this is a comparison. This is like the what happens, how much TC is suppressed. If you don't know J0, you do not know what these things mean, but TC is suppressed. Now what we do here, what I'm showing you here, is that I'm putting in now the direct antiferromagnetic coupling. So this is not a dipole-dipole coupling, this is the nearest neighbor antiferromagnetic coupling. So this is the, oh, by the way, I should emphasize that the phase outside the ferromagnetic regime, we are calling that non-ferromagnetic phase. We are not calling them a paramagnetic phase. In fact, I don't believe that there is just one phase here. We spent 6 months trying to identify these phases, very hard. I believe there are many phases here, okay? Many different phases, different kind of glasses. It's definitely not a simple paramagnet. But it's not a non-collinear ferromagnet. We just check that. If it's a non-collinear ferromagnet, then most of it, you know, moment is basically close to zero. So it goes back to what you found. And there may be some non-collinear right around here. That we cannot rule out. Okay? But over here, you know, somewhere it's a pure paramagnet. But over here, there are interesting phases which we are going to study over the next few years. You know, never mind that. Experimenters are not interested in this regime. I'm interested in this regime. This regime is boring as far as I'm concerned, ferromagnet. This regime is interesting. So now what happens when you turn on antiferromagnetic couplings? Antiferromagnetic coupling is between two manganese atoms, and it's only nearest neighbor coupling, because that's what, only when the two manganese are nearest neighbor is coupling, and the values are zero, that's this one, and then 1, 2, 10. So remember, Nithin and Thomas told us it's of the order of 10. Well, if it's 10, then this figure changes like this, and it says that for manganese concentration larger than 0.2, you'll not have anything. If it's 20, then it will explain Ono's observation that I showed you, that it goes up and comes down. So it will tell you that, well, it will, ferromagnet will disappear by the time you go to 8%. So I have absolutely no doubt that the direct antiferromagnetic exchange between manganese is playing a very important role, because experimentally, you know, by the time anybody has put 0.1, ferromagnetism has disappeared. In Ono's original experiment, disappeared by the time they put 0.7, and this is 10. Yesterday, I heard the actual coupling maybe 20 times. So if it's 20, it'll be looking something like this. Okay. So this is showing you that, because now you have two kinds of frustration. You have frustration arising from RKKY itself, plus additional frustration imposed by the direct antiferromagnetic exchange. So this is the same figure with antiferromagnetic exchange corresponding to this. So you know, things keep on shifting. And this is just posted yesterday. So you may ask, okay, what is the maximum value of NC over NI? You know, it's this tail. Does this tail go forever? What is the maximum value of NC over NI where ferromagnetism is possible? We can actually analytically calculate that using power correlation theory, and that's about 1.2. But that's a very, very small value of X, like X 0.01. And TC is very, very small there. It's not of any experimental significance. But theoretically, you find that the maximum value of NC over NI where ferromagnetism is possible is 1.2. But TC will be exponentially small, and X will be very, very small also. So this is the full RKKY phase diagram. This is what you have to compare the virtual crystal approximation type theory that you heard from Thomas Jungwirth the other day. What he's doing this mean field theory, very nice theory, but he's putting all the band structure effects in there, which certainly needs to be done. You can do that or this. So this is like two alternate approaches to the physics. If you think band structure is the most important thing, then you have ferromagnetism everywhere, and then you do band structure with TC. We are now looking at the phase diagram more and trying to understand what the phases are. So, we also identified the transition to be power correlation transition, but let me not get into that. And all this conclusion I've already told you. Then I'm just going to say one more thing, and then I'm going to shut up. Oh, by the way, this is T is equal to zero. This is quite interesting. Disorder here works very much like finite temperature. So what I'm showing you here is Donald's numerical calculation for magnetization as a function of carrier density. Okay, and here is 3D Ising result, numerical result, as a function of temperature. And we find that this is well known in the power correlation literature. The disorder acts very much like, so disorder fluctuations, spatial fluctuations act very much like thermal fluctuations when you have power correlation driven ferromagnetic transition. And you see something, yeah, qualitatively, that's something like that. Okay, so just have your, you know, the partition function, you have partition function for the temperature thing, and you have the disorder average for the spatial fluctuations thing. So the last thing I'll tell you is the question that somebody asked, that do you really calculate this RKKY interaction microscopically? And the answer is no. We assume it to be RKKY because that seems to be the model. So how should one go about calculating it? Well, this is our Hamiltonian. I need to ask, can I solve this Hamiltonian exactly? Well, if you take this Hamiltonian and you do a second order perturbation theory in J, then you immediately get RKKY interaction. I assume all the students and postdocs, you all know that, right? Because that's what Ruderman and Kittel and Yoshida and Kashua did in mid-50s. They took and did a second order perturbation theory calculation. Actually, it was done by Nabarro and Frolish in mid-40s. Okay? So if you do a second order calculation, you immediately get RKKY interaction. But that's only when J is small. If J is large, you cannot do perturbation theory. If J is large, you can do something else. So we did what is called dynamical mean field theory, where you do not make an assumption about J. And then, so I'm not going to give you the details of dynamical mean field theory. Either you know what it is, then this makes sense. If you don't know, this is too little for you to know what is going on. It's a well-defined theory in the strong coupling regime, okay? It's basically an infinite dimensional theory. And basically what you find is that for small J, so what I'm showing you is that what the band looks like. You calculate the band exactly. For small J, so you have the spin up and spin down band. For small J, they're basically like the unperturbed band, okay? So there's things don't change much. But when J is large, then you start having split up band. So this is for small J, not much is happening. A little bit something is happening. But for very large J, the impedance band splits off. And clearly, for this J, you cannot talk about RKKY anymore. This is more like double exchange. This is basically the transition from weak coupling to strong coupling, okay? And where is gallium manganese arsenide? Our best estimate shows somewhere here, where you're intermediate between RKKY and double exchange. And double exchange impedance band has split off, and you really have to do impedance band calculation, and Andy Millis and I, with a couple of postdocs, did these calculations, and I'm not going to go into the details, it doesn't really matter. A lot of people believe that this impedance band picture, where all the action is here, is really the correct picture. There will be metal insert transition here. I personally do not have a view, because our RKKY will be valid here also, except now I have to use a cutoff. Because in the impurity band, the interaction is short range, so you need a cutoff, and the basic conclusion that I had would apply there also. We can calculate TC as a function of various parameters. We can calculate the magnetization, and we can actually compare with experiment, and we can calculate resistivity. We can calculate resistivity in various regimes. We get pretty good agreement with experiment in using this DMFT. This is work with Juan late last year. And we also calculated optical properties. And this is what actually Dmitry Basov, who gave a talk here, I know, these are the theoretical results he was using to claim that his experiment definitively shows that the system is not RKKY system. System is not valence band system. It's all in the impedance band because he clearly sees this structure that he predicted. By the way, our paper, which referees thought were very uninteresting and came out as a brief report, predicted this behavior. This experiment, this theory paper preceded the experiment. It's not after the experiment. We said one way of distinguishing whether it's valence band physics or impedance band physics is to find this peak, mid-gap peak. And the mid-gap peak was found, but immediately McDonald and Sinova had an explanation using intra-valence band transition. But there is a way to distinguish that, and that's what Basov did over the last 2 years. And he finds it was very similar to this. And he at least claims that his work definitively shows that this is what is going on. I really don't have a viewpoint on it. I'm not working on this anymore. But so we have done other calculations using this. And I'm just going to stop there. We have results on power correlation, but I think that 1 hour and 50 minutes is long enough to stretch people's patience. Maybe I'll just go to the conclusion, general conclusion, and which I may have somewhere, which I may not. I was not planning on talking about all of this. My style is to keep everything together. Here is the general conclusion. So this is kind of trying to answer some of the questions I posed in the first slide. So magnetic doping works, meaning it does lead to ferromagnetism. And you have strong competition between ferromagnetism and antiferromagnetism, with antiferromagnetism arising from both RKKY and direct exchange, and you have to both include Then we have to include both. Now, we have answered some of those questions, but we have not answered all of them. And only careful comparison between experiment and theory will answer all of them. My own view of gallium manganese arsenide is that, I should tell you my view, I should not hedge, is that it's the intermediate region between valence band and impurity band, where the impurity band overlaps so strongly with valence band, the picture that I was showing you, you know, it's a picture something like, so it's like this, but this is more like this, okay? There's something like this. When the picture is like this, whether you should include an impurity band picture or a valence band picture may depend on the experiments one is doing. And then things become very complicated. And I think, unfortunately, gallium manganese arsenide may be in that regime. But some of the other materials, I think, are impurity band. I think most of these materials are impurity band ferromagnet, not valence band or free carrier ferromagnet, most of these. But gallium manganese arsenide may be kind of both. And I think all the transitions are percolation transition because they are really the very strong disorder regime. Okay? I'm going to stop there. Thank you.
So, Shankar, in principle, you can also calculate the effective exchange coupling of manganese using the 6-10 model.
Absolutely.
Have you done that?
No, because the thing is that you cannot calculate using effective 6-band model if all the action is in the impurity band, right? You have to do a full band structure then.
I agree.
Right, yeah. I mean, the thing is that I really, you know, this experiment agreement that we did also to publish PRL because refer is forces, I really dislike. Because I have one unknown TC, I have another unknown J. All this does is takes the unknown from TC and puts it in J. It's better to think of it as overall scale and look at comparisons. No, we have not done that mainly because it's certainly very doable because I personally don't see the point because you're not even agreeing on the model, you know. So I did not do it and I'm not going to do it. What we are going to do, I'm going to only work on one problem of spintronics, which is I'm going to work on this disordered magnetism using this Monte Carlo technique for the next 5 years, trying to identify all the phases, not just gallium manganese arsenide in general. I think that is the most interesting thing coming out of everything in percolation theory. Nothing more can be done. You know, we predicted Griffith's phase.
But now you're saying that the disorder really play a crucial role.
And I think disorder plays
more the impurity band rather than
right.
The semiconductor.
Right. I think disorder plays a crucial role from a fundamental physicist perspective. Meaning disorder plays a very crucial role in determining the phase diagram. Most of those phases, spintronics community is not interested in. Spintronics community interested in high TC regime. But from a fundamental physics viewpoint, I think those other phases are very important. I should show you my phase diagram, which I promised I'll show you, and that will tell you why I'm interested in that. So I filled in the phase diagram based on all the things that we learned, some of which I talked about. So if you look at this phase diagram now, what I'm trying to tell you is that here's this is the region we're not filling in, as you noticed, with RKKY, okay? And for example, here, Nitin is working here because we find, using our percolation argument, that there's a random magnetic glass here. Okay, this is work I did not work with Viktor Galitsky again. I didn't get to talk about real space RG work. And over here, of course, everybody agrees when the impedance is very high, you have direct antiferromagnetic interaction, you have frustration, you have valence bond glass, random spin ordering, antiferromagnetic glass. Notice that I have not used the word spin glass because for RKKY system, it's not known whether there is a spin glass in the sense of Edwards Anderson order parameter. Simulation has not settled that question. So I'm much more interested, you know, in these phases than this regime. To me, this regime is boring. But this regime is, of course, of technological interest. And all the microscopic things you're asking, you know, knowing what the coupling constant is, knowing spin rate coupling, very important in predicting behavior here. And it's good. Thomas Jungwirth is, you know, working very hard in that regime. It doesn't make any sense for both of us doing similar things. And I am much more interested in this regime, in this regime, in this regime. And in other materials, some of these regimes are much larger. And in those regimes, disorder is very, very important. Okay? Disorder may not be that important over here, predicting TC, as I showed you. Okay? In fact, TC, if in the most best regime where the mean free path is very long, within a factor of 2 or 3, you'll get correct TC. So I hope I'm making myself very clear why I think these regimes are interesting. Okay? And I myself will work only on those regimes. Right. So spin orbit coupling is definitely very important, but spin orbit coupling and people have what I didn't tell you, as I said, I didn't tell you anything about what others did. So other groups, Luis Bray, for example, one of my collaborators in Madrid, He did a wonderful calculation, and in fact, he's that time student, he's a postdoc with me now, where he did Monte Carlo simulation, nowhere near a sophisticated Monte Carlo simulation, using the Indo-Luttinger model, keeping all the six bands. And he showed that TCLB enhanced compared with the Bayer RKQI result, which is very understandable. Basically, what is happening, you can think of warping up the bands as KF going down, so it suppresses frustration. That's exactly what you would expect. So he stayed in the ferromagnetic regime, including warping, and that's very important. If you want to predict TC, those things are very important. Now, let's say that if you want to know the property of gallium manganese arsenide in details, you have to include spin orbit. I did not agree with you more. But if you're interested in the topology of the phase diagram, then I do not think they're as important. What would happen is the phase diagram will shift. Ferromagnetic regime will become somewhat more robust, a bit outside, but somewhere else it will. The problem is that you cannot do both together. That's the reason we are not doing spin orbit. If we put spin orbit here, we try to do that. The numerical cost at each step, solving Schrodinger equation. I mean, these are each Monte Carlo step is many hours, each after averaging. So, I mean, someday maybe we'll do it, but right now I have to either do this or that. So I'm not saying spin orbit coupling is not important. I'm saying I do not know how important they are. And the best work is Louis Braze, where he finds that TC will be enhanced by a factor of 2 to 3 compared with non-spin orbit couple situation.
It's really old, because if you think about what does it do, what does it do?
It's one. Death is one. Yeah.
And that, so what it does, it locks your thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
If you have this order, these locking directions will gradually sort of change.
Right. And what we are planning on, there is, and in fact, there is a whole, whole controversy there also. There's a group that claimed that that actually changes everything, and then others did simulation. In fact, Louis Braze again found, no, that doesn't quite happen. So what we're planning on doing is to put in model spin orbit coupling along the line you just said in our Heisenberg model. That we can do. We don't have to do in a six-band Luttinger model, but we can put in exactly along the line you said, log the spin, with spin orbit coupling, that will do. And we'll parameterize that. That will do. That we can do because you don't have to do some Schrodinger equation every step. So it's a good question that spin orbit coupling will change things and that should be included. But then it's not RKKY phase diagram. Then it's RKKY plus SO phase diagram. What came to me as a big surprise that RKKY phase diagram has not been calculated, in spite of the fact that RKKY has been studied intensively for 50 years. You know, you'd have thought somebody would have the phase diagram, but Kirsten also verified my conclusion that he looked into it also and he found no one has done it. But I guess you didn't publish it because you're not quite confident about the results. It was done by a student, you said, or something?
Yeah, it was just half a year of master thesis work, so we didn't do as careful a job as you did.
But your results, if I understand you correctly, are not inconsistent with what I'm saying, right?
Well, very fragile,
yeah.
But you gave
the
reasons.
Right, absolutely. Yes, please.
So your theory comes from the imaginary pattern,
yeah.
Encoded in the
green, yeah,
function.
Yeah.
Right.
Right, exactly. If you do the direct calculation.
A is the lattice constant.
A is the lattice constant. A doesn't play any role in that. A is just, it just happens to be that number. A is lattice constant, yes. But no. If you take the experimental conductivity and convert that blindly into a mean free path, they find a number 1 angstrom or 2 angstrom. These are not your ordinary metals. These are called bad metals. The resistivity is very high. If you convert it into dimensionless, resistance, it's much larger than your Fedegal value. So A actually in most cases less than A because A is more like 3-4 angstrom. And this has been a debate I'm carrying with these people, so that whenever they say metal, I said, what do you mean by metal? Say it's not strongly temperature dependent. It really is not any metal one knows.
What is the value of the imaginary program, right?
Right.
So that is, could you expect some long-range
GMS in the situation? Zaleshansky Moria, yes. In fact, we believe that in 2D, that's what stabilizes the ferromagnetism. And you should look at our PRL that we had there, where we included that interaction, because there was a very smart referee. He said, in 2D, there is no ferromagnetism. We said, well, but there will be Zaleshansky Moria, because of, and then he made us do the calculation, and we did it, and we found that stabilizes things. But I don't think, other than doing little qualitative things like that, it's very quantitatively very important. But I could be wrong, okay? I don't think it's quantitatively very important. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your staying and you know, listening to me. You didn't have to do that. And let's thank Gate for struggling through the whole Spintronics workshop, essentially all by himself, okay? I'm not making it up. I have been here from day one, and he's the coordinator who ran the whole thing, I would say, I don't know, 90% or some such number.
Oh, that was not easy.
No, that, I mean, that's okay. I mean, there is that. You got more out of it also, right?
Okay, other organizer.